I want to welcome everyone here today. I want to welcome Joshua Dubois. It is so exciting to see you all here. When I was coming into the room just now, someone said, "What a great room of people." And that's the way I feel. My name, by the way, is E.J. Dion. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings. And I want to say at the outset that you actually are, you and the folks who are coming in the course of the day, a truly extraordinary audience. It's amazing how much good work and how many good works are represented in this room. You represent a very broad range of opinion, a very broad range of faith traditions. You include non-believers as well as believers, many different political points of view. As I say, the groups you are a part of account for a lot of good work in our country. There is some disagreement among us here over exactly how government should help faith-based groups, but I think we all join together to honor the extraordinary work done by faith and community groups and also to honor religious liberty. There is such political polarization right now, some people might even say, in some other job I have, I'm partly responsible for it. But there is such political polarization now that I think it's worth celebrating the commitments that people bring to their faith and to their communities, and that those commitments often bridge the most vexing political divides in our country. As Dr. King said, we can hew out of a mountain of despair a stone of hope. We can transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. So welcome everyone to our symphony today. And today is actually devoted to the very practical work that these aspirations require. We're here to look at how government partnerships with faith-based and community groups have worked in recent years to examine the changes and continuities of federal policy in this area under President Obama and to look ahead. I will say no more because I can't wait to hear our opening speaker, Joshua. I was going to introduce him, but just to compress the program, I asked my dear friend Melissa to introduce him. We're very, very happy to have him with us today and all our other distinguished speakers and panelists. So I just want to pause for a brief moment to say a few thank yous. The first is to my dear friend and Brookings colleague, John DiIulio, who just sent us an email this morning. John was hoping to be here, and there was a sickness in his family. He had to rush off for that, but we are going to miss him today. John has inspired so many of us to engage in work and study in this area. He's deeply inspiring to me. In fact, when I look at all the work John does for the least among us, it just makes me feel very guilty. But since I am a Catholic, that is my natural state. He inspired Brookings's earliest work in this area. And 13 years ago, in this room, John and I organized a meeting very much like this one. Some of you are actually there at that meeting. It was one of the very early public discussions of faith-based partnerships. John is indispensable to so many here, certainly to me, and to so many people in so many communities. I also want to thank Luis Lugo and the Pew Charitable Trust. I have to say, they are in no way responsible for this meeting. They are absolved of any responsibility for what we do here. But they were very important to us in our early work in this area, and I remain very grateful. I want to express deep gratitude to Seymour Weingarten. Where are you, Seymour? Welcome. And also to Dave Myers. Without them, this meeting simply wouldn't have happened. And without Seymour, so much of the work Melissa and I have undertaken over the last couple of years would have been impossible. And I have to thank Darrell West, the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies here at Brookings. We stole Darrell from Brown University, and I am so grateful that we did. He is a spectacular colleague, and he's been really enthusiastic and supportive of our work. pardon me. And lastly, but not least, it is my pleasure to thank and introduce Melissa Rogers. I'm proud to say she's a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings. She's a professor at Wake Forest Divinity School. We're partners on this in setting up this meeting. She and I have been working together on issues related to religion and public life for a decade, and what a joy it has been. And I want to tell President Obama, through Joshua, that I am proud to have found Melissa long before he did. She joined, as some of you know, she joined the President's Faith-Based Council right when it was set up. She became its chair in January. Wherever she is and whatever she is doing, I hope I have a chance to work with Melissa Rogers. So welcome, Melissa.
Thank you so much. And EJ, thank you for that exceedingly generous introduction. Any of you know who have had the wonderful opportunity to work with EJ, it's both a delight and an inspiration. And I'm grateful, deeply grateful for the chance to work with him and to continue our work together. And I want to thank all of you for coming this morning. I want to thank Seymour Weingarten in particular and Dave Myers for being here and supporting our work, and all the other thanks that EJ gave, I want to underscore. I also want to thank Joshua for being here with us this morning. He, as you know, is Special Assistant to President Obama and Executive Director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. In this capacity, Dubois helps direct the Obama administration's engagement with faith-based and other nonprofit organizations. He's one of he's very young, but he's one of President Obama's longest-serving aides. Joshua was a legislative aide to then Senator Obama. He also spent time working for Representatives Rush Holt and Charles Rangel. He also has been an associate pastor of a small Pentecostal church in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he received a master's in public affairs from Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School and a bachelor's degree from Boston University. Joshua was raised in Nashville, Tennessee. I can say that it's a great pleasure and honor to work with Joshua, and I can also say with great confidence that I surely didn't have the skills and composure in my mid-20s that Joshua possesses. So welcome, Joshua. We're very much looking forward to hearing from you.
Thank you,
Joshua. Thank you, Joshua.
Well, let us pray. I'm just kidding, guys. I'm sorry.
You can do that.
Is Barry here? Please don't. Good morning, everyone. It's really a pleasure, excuse me, to be here this morning. And thank you, EJ and Melissa, for that wonderful welcome. It's been an honor to work with and learn from both of you for quite a while now. And I'm deeply appreciative of your leadership in this critical arena of faith and public life. I also want to thank members of our staff at the White House and across federal agency centers that have joined us today, especially our core team at the White House of Mara Vanderslice and Michael Weir and Ben Odell. I want to thank the members of our Presidential Advisory Council and other key leaders who are going to participate in panels throughout the rest of the day. It promises to be a fascinating series of conversations, and I'm really glad that the Brookings Institute put this all together. And finally, on behalf of President Obama, I want to thank all of you. I want to thank you for being here today, but more importantly, for your interest in helping the federal government navigate the fascinating and important and sometimes fraught currents of religion in American life. Through your work with nonprofit organizations and churches, through your scholarly efforts, through your reporting and your blogging and advocacy and even litigation, you are partaking in the difficult but rewarding task of finding an appropriate intersection between personal faith and public affairs. That journey, that search for the right balance between religion and politics in America, is one President Obama has been on for quite a long time. And for a number of years, I've been honored to walk that road with him. I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the work of our office today and the road ahead. But first, I'd like to tell you a little bit about how this all started. My first foray into the mix of religion and politics was with this president was in the late summer and fall of 2005. The president was, of course, the junior senator from Illinois at the time, working hard on behalf of the good folks of Chicago and downstate and all the points in between. And I was a very young Senate staffer for him, fresh out of graduate school in public affairs and some brief time on the Hill, still affiliated as an associate pastor with a small church in Cambridge, Mass. The president's Christian faith was very important to him, as it is today. And as not only a Christian, but also a constitutional scholar, then Senator Obama had strong beliefs about how religion and the government could responsibly connect and where those two forces should diverge as well. But he had never put all of this together in one speech before. One message to the people of Illinois and the American people as well. Senator Obama had not yet in a public forum shared his views on how we can all reconcile our private values with our public lives. Nor had he spoken of the ways that he seeks to do this each and every day. So one day he called me in his office, and I was joined by some folks who remain good friends and mentors to this day, Pete Rouse and Mike Strautmanis. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing, guys, I want to give a major address about religion in America, about my faith, but also about the ways that all Americans live out their values in the public square. But before he gave the speech, Senator Obama said he wanted to start by learning more about how religious organizations were impacting society in communities across the country. He wanted his address to be informed by the work of groups on the ground, meeting human needs. And he wanted us to go out and learn about and from these groups in advance of his speech. So as the most junior person in that room by at least 20 years, that task was, of course, assigned to me. And over the next few weeks, which grew into months, I believe I pestered probably every religious group in Washington and a good many across the country. I sat down with the Friends Committee and learned about their efforts around peace. I talked with my friends at Catholic Charities about SCHIP and went to my mainline Protestant friends on Maryland Avenue to learn more about Church World Service. I called evangelical pastors around the country and connected with a young man named Ibu Patel about interfaith service. I used my vacation time to attend annual conventions of historically black denominations and began pestering Rabbi David Saperstein at the RAC and Nathan Diamond at the Orthodox Union, an activity that, unfortunately for them, persists to this day. From coffee with church-state experts to meetings with my Buddhist friends, I worked to expand my own knowledge of the religious and community-based landscape in our country, knowledge which had been limited to life as a preacher's kid and classroom study and time in service to my own church. And the main question that I had during the search was, how are these organizations and individuals impacting the world around them? What role, if any, should the government play in supporting that good work? And finally, what were the opportunities for navigating religious difference and the contours of pluralism, which includes non-believers as well, in order to find common purpose on the most difficult issues that we face as a nation? After hundreds of conversations and coffees and conventions, I reported back to the president on what I'd learned. And he took that information and subsequent conversations in and combined it with his own rich history of living and working at the intersection of faith and public life. And then he wove all of this together in a major address at Reverend Jim Wallace's Call to Renewal Conference in the early summer of 2006. The president's Call to Renewal speech is perhaps his most important address on religion, one that is often overlooked but I believe is deeply illuminating of our work today. In fact, one of the sponsors of today's event, our good friend EJ, said at the time that then-Senator Obama's speech may be the most important pronouncement by a Democrat on faith and politics since John F. Kennedy's Houston speech in 1960. In this speech, the president talked about his own Christian walk. He also spoke to the fissures that too often divide people of faith in religious and secular America and proposed some basic principles for, as he said at the time, joining a serious debate about how to reconcile faith with our modern pluralistic democracy. It was a speech with a number of key messages and a candid personal account as well, but I believe one of the core bottom lines was this, that faith and values can be tremendous forces for good in our world, and government can enable some of that good work, but only when we have a clear eye on our core constitutional commitments and when we can disagree without being disagreeable and seek out common ground wherever we can. The president, of course, said it much more eloquently than I just did, but it's that belief, that core belief, that motivates our work to this day. President Obama announced the formation of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships on February 5, 2009, and placed it strategically within the Domestic Policy Council. However, our work on this office, in fact, started months before that announcement, with the help of some good friends deeply invested in these issues, including Melody Barnes, the head of the DPC, and Mark Linton, who's the director of our HUD Center today, and I believe is here today. We spent the time between Election Day and the office's announcement examining what worked in the previous effort, what didn't work, and developing the framework for this office. That effort helped us identify both some real opportunities and formidable challenges. On the opportunity side, the first and most important asset left behind by the previous administration was the structure of the office itself. It is unique in the federal government in that we have one White House office with a coordinating relationship with multiple agency centers around government. Each of these centers is tasked with connecting their own federal agency to local faith-based and other nonprofit organizations. This interagency structure is really an enormous benefit. It means that across bureaucratic lines, we can collaborate immediately on the issues that impact nonprofit organizations in a way that few other offices can. This structure itself is a testimony to the foresight of some good folks in the previous administration, including President Bush himself. However, during the transition period, we found some real challenges as well. Most immediately, while there were some very high-performing agency centers that built specific policy initiatives, workforce development at the Department of Labor and the Mentoring Children of Prisoners program at HHS really stand out, many of these centers left behind uncertain evidence of their impact. In fact, outside of the great work of a few centers, many of the smaller centers appeared to focus almost exclusively on distributing announcements about federal grants, if that. We also found that legal and constitutional issues confronted the initiative. Issues like helping grantees appropriately segment their funds and ensuring the protection of beneficiary rights were left unattended without a specific plan for addressing these crucial topics. And finally, perhaps most importantly, the public perception of the faith-based initiative was at best erroneous, especially towards the end, and at worst, deeply negative. This perception deserves further explanation. Dating back to my time in the Senate, and certainly throughout the 2008 campaign, there was one overarching view that I recall so many others having about the faith-based initiative. It was all about the money. From storefront churches in South Carolina to huge congregations in the Midwest, everyone from religious leaders to civil libertarians had the perception that the faith-based office consisted of a big pot of money in the White House. Dollars that everybody knew about, but only a few had access to. Now, to be fair, this perception may not have reflected the reality of the initiative. It's an often misunderstood point that there's absolutely no dedicated funding stream specifically for faith-based groups. And the White House Faith-Based Office and our affiliated agency centers have no role in the decisions about federal grants. But the perception existed nonetheless, and it was reinforced by the day-to-day work of the office and its centers, which had the appearance, at least, of measuring their success based on the dollar amounts that flowed to faith-based groups. And it is this fundamental issue, this dollar-driven perception and mission, that we knew we had to tackle in President Obama's iteration of the Faith-Based Office. We had to tackle it because at the end of the day, the president knows that the relationship between the federal government and religious organizations must not be about money alone. Many faith-based groups do not want to receive federal funds because of the various restrictions attached to it, attached to those dollars. Many others should not receive federal grants because they're either unable or unwilling to separate those funds and use them through appropriate means. So we must find a way to work with the vast majority of those faith-based organizations who will not receive money from the government, while ensuring, of course, that those who wish to apply for and receive federal support do so in a way that respects both their rights and responsibilities. So if we're turning the corner on this dollar-focused perception, if it's not all about money, what's the whole thing about now? How are we shifting our core measurements of success, the way we define ourselves? What's the guiding vision for President Obama's Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships? Well, our guiding vision is this: to connect with faith-based and other neighborhood organizations on specific challenges confronting our communities and partner with those groups to strengthen their good work. Critically, this support may not always be about federal grants. We don't measure our success based on how many dollars flow to faith-based organizations. Instead, we measure our success based on the impact that our partnerships with faith-based and other neighborhood groups have on individuals and families and communities across the country. This is a fundamental shift, one that does not necessarily lend itself to a soundbite, but is critical to the future of the faith-based initiative nonetheless. By serving as a convener, by sharing critical information, by building organizational capacity, by catalyzing private support, and still, where appropriate, informing organizations of the grants that they can apply for, we seek to be a nimble, creative, and flexible supporter of faith-based and other nonprofit organizations around the country. It's not just about the dollars and cents. Instead, it's about impacts on individuals and families and communities. Let me give you a few concrete examples of how this shift has borne itself out over the last year. This year at our partnership center at HHS, we spent a tremendous amount of time working with local houses of worship and other nonprofits on developing and tapping into their existing public health infrastructure. We used the challenge of the H1N1 crisis to create a toolkit for faith-based groups and other community leaders to help them respond to the virus. And now we're working with these same organizations to make sure that when future public health challenges come down the road, they have the ability to keep their own congregations safe and be havens for their communities as well. This effort did not involve a transfer of money to faith-based organizations. Instead, it involved a collaborative sharing and receiving of knowledge that helped to protect families around the country. And if we build on our success in the public health arena and create lasting connections that work not just for H1N1, but also future public health challenges, then our efforts will help make communities across the country healthier and safer. This is a critical new partnership enabled by the new vision of our office. Another example is our work around fatherhood. For years, President Obama has been deeply concerned with the challenge of father absence in America and the attendant outcomes that drives for children around the country, particularly in communities where the rates of father involvement are particularly low. In response to this, we've led the administration's approach to fatherhood issues and launched a national conversation on fatherhood. We convene local groups for regional efforts on fatherhood, and by the end of next month, we will have engaged 5 cabinet secretaries in that work. We're learning from these very same organizations about what works and what doesn't, and we use that knowledge to help lead a policy process with HHS that culminated in the recent president's budget announcement of a new Fatherhood, Marriage, and Family Innovation Fund that puts community impacts first. This work as a convener has also been expressed in the mentoring field. Prior to a major event we did with the president, we brought together mentoring organizations like Mentor, Inc. and corporations like Viacom. In a partnership that led to Viacom sponsoring of mentoring programs at their corporate offices around the country. This is a new way of doing things. The list of partnerships goes on. We worked with groups to sponsor over 4,000 interfaith service projects during the administration's United We Serve Summer of Service campaign. Right now, we're working through our AIDS Center, a center at USAID, to bring together NGOs in collaboration around Haiti response. We launched a new Feed a Neighbor Anti-Hunger Initiative, and we're working with the broader Domestic Policy Council and White House Council on Women and Girls on a common ground agenda around unintended pregnancy and reducing the need for abortion, an effort that has engaged many of our council members. And we joined with the National Security Council and the State Department and others on the President's address in Cairo and ensuring that the State Department could ably follow up on that speech to engage religious and civic communities abroad. These partnerships with local organizations are not about money alone. They're not about picking winners and losers. Instead, they're about partnering with groups and sectors to have an impact on real-world problems. That's how we'll measure our success. And that's how, slowly but surely, we're turning the perception and reality of the faith-based initiative around. We have some help in this effort, including a first-of-its-kind Presidential Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. This body was established to provide advice to the president and to our office on how the federal government can more effectively partner with faith-based and other nonprofit organizations. It's a wonderfully diverse group, progressives and conservatives from different religious and non-religious backgrounds, folks who may agree with the president on many issues and many who don't. This reflects the broader approach of our office. We're making sure that people know, no matter what background you're from, whether you are religious or secular, and regardless of your political perspective, your views are welcome in this office and on our council. And although the council's first year of work has not yet concluded, they've done a terrific job so far. They're focusing on 6 core areas where the government might improve its partnerships with local faith-based and other nonprofit organizations. Partnerships that relate to the economic recovery and domestic poverty, environmental issues, fatherhood and healthy families, interreligious dialogue, global poverty, and the reform of the faith-based office itself. They are approaching consensus on the vast majority of their recommendations across religious and partisan and ideological lines. And even when they disagree, they've done so with civility and respect. We're very much looking forward to their final report and to receiving their recommendations for how the government and local groups can better serve American families. The other thing that helps us beyond the council, is a new focus on the legal and constitutional footing of our office. We intentionally tasked the advisory council with formulating recommendations to improve this footing. When their final report is released, It will include key advice on issues like developing easily accessible guidance for faith-based organizations that equally emphasize separation requirements as well as protections for religious identity. It'll recommend around higher standards for transparency of federally funded partnerships and assuring that the rights of beneficiaries of federally funded social services are protected. We also continue to work with our colleagues in government to take a clear-eyed approach to other difficult issues, including religious hiring. We know that there is a tremendous desire for finality on this topic, but we also know that due to its importance, decisions must be made carefully and with all due diligence. That's a process we're in and one we take very seriously. Now, stepping back to the big picture, it's important to note that there are some downsides to this new focus on partnerships instead of dollars alone. While these partnerships are deeply important and I believe far more impactful for everyday Americans, they may not always be front page news, and some have deemed them as less substantial than other guiding visions. Fights over dollars and cents and quibbles about religious politics are far more attractive to our good friends in the media and partisans on both sides than helping faith-based organizations respond to disasters and strengthen families and ensure that at-risk young folks have mentors and promote interfaith cooperation abroad. That criticism comes with the territory, and I imagine it will persist. But it makes the work no less important. And in fact, I believe that work is far more important than the majority of controversies discussed about this office. Another challenge is if you're going to do partnerships thoughtfully and measure your work, it takes time. In just a year of operation, and actually much less for many of our centers, I'm deeply proud of what we've been able to accomplish. But we're setting up for so much more in the years ahead. For example, our advisory council has not yet even concluded the process of making its recommendations. We are working to form a new interagency working group on nonprofit capacity building to develop a strategic plan for streamlining capacity building efforts across government. For the first time, we're convening an interagency effort on religion and global affairs with the National Security Council, and that effort will soon begin its work. We'll spend the next year forming new partnerships to close the mentoring gap, ensure that nonprofits are a part of our economic recovery, and work with local faith-based and other neighborhood organizations on critical environmental issues. These and other efforts will take time, as will the broader process of helping to shift how the public views the faith-based initiative. They also do not easily lend themselves to the brief analysis of a news cycle. So I imagine that as this work proceeds, we'll take some bumps and bruises. But we will keep going with the focus on our long-range vision of impacting American communities through innovative and measurable and constitutional partnerships. As I conclude this speech and as we continue our work, I think back to two of the very first groups I visited upon entering this position. I wanted to get out of the building a bit, so I went to visit two outstanding local organizations here in Washington. Covenant House, a faith-based group, and Life Pieces to Masterpieces, which is not. Now, Covenant House is the local branch of a national faith-based organization, and they do tremendous work with young people experiencing homelessness. The executive director of that organization took me around to meet some of the young folks who were working on their resumes at computer terminals and learning new skills through a tremendous program, the job training program they call Off the Block Artisans, and helping young parents connect with their families. I then went over to Life Pieces, and I met Mary Brown, who's the executive director of that organization. And she told me about Life Pieces' work as an after-school and summer program for some of the most at-risk boys and young men in the district. In fact, many of these guys, and it's not an overstatement, had experienced extreme violence in their homes, often the murder or assault of a parent or loved one. And Life Pieces takes an innovative approach to helping these young men find a better path. They use art. All of the boys, whether they're 6 years old or 26, work together to paint masterpieces. Beautiful, collaborative paintings, stirring pictures that depict both the challenges of their lives and the hope that they see ahead. Many of these paintings were visually stunning and really stopped me in my tracks. Now, this was a moving experience for me in an innovative mode of service, but more importantly, it's working. Life Pieces' work with these young men after school and in the summers is having a measurable impact on their rates of high school completion and college entrance, on how they view themselves, and how they navigate the world around them. And I decided that I wanted this office to be a resource for groups like Life Pieces. Sometimes that may be through financial partnerships, making sure that they can compete on an equal basis for federal grants. But other times it may be about civic partnerships, using our convening power to bring them together with like-minded organizations, helping bring private resources to the table where appropriate, sitting down with them, and listening and learning so that their good work can shape our policy. We have to be flexible. We have to listen more than we talk. And we have to both expand our vision of partnerships while at the same time tightening it around core constitutional principles. And if we can do that, I believe we can move this faith-based initiative forward. And maybe, just maybe, we can contribute to the work that then-Senator Obama challenged us to do in his call to renewal address years ago, the work of reconciling the beliefs of each of us with the good of all. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. I want to invite folks in the back. There are seats out up front here. It's like church. The front seats are always empty. It's come on up, please. I noticed, by the way, did you notice that Joshua said he welcomed even litigation? And it reminded me of John DiIulio when he was in the equivalent of Joshua's job, was looking at a group one day, and he said, in America, we don't really care about something unless we're willing to go to court, so sue me, he said to the crowd. For the record, Joshua did not say that. And the other thing is, I want to welcome Stanley Carlson Tease, who is in the Bush faith-based office. And when Joshua mentioned that big pot of money, he smiled and nodded knowingly. So I assume he knows where that big pot of money went. But yeah, we're going to get it out of you before the meeting's over. Let me start, and then I want to ask two questions. One, playing the role of that dastardly, divisive media that you mentioned, and the other, not. The first is, I was talking the other day to my friend Mary Bogle, who noted there are 6 million children in the country who will spend their entire lives in poverty, from their entire childhood in poverty. And I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask, which is kind of outside the framework of the usual church-state debate that we have around this, is it not the role of an office like this to put people like that much more in the forefront of our public discussions, that you are almost in a unique place to get people's attention on the left out? And I just wonder, and is there more that can be done in that area? And then playing the classically divisive journalistic role, there was that piece in the Wall Street Journal the other day about some of the more progressive groups being sort of, especially on the civil liberties issues, being frustrated. I have had the sense that you have very carefully tried to avoid controversy in this area for a variety of actually quite sensible political reasons. And I noticed that when you talked about the hiring issue, the words you used were carefully and with all due diligence. Could you talk about the whole notion that your first task coming in has been to kind of avoid controversy in this area, and why is that simply a wrong-headed journalistic view on my part?
Well, taking those in turn, and great questions. The first one, certainly we have a role in addressing domestic poverty, but through the lens of partnerships with local nonprofits. So there are two parts of that. If we can connect through our agency centers or through the White House with local nonprofits and help them better serve those in greatest need, and that's something that we are committed to do and that we do across our centers. But on broader sort of topics of public debate related to poverty in our country, we focus on making sure that religious voices are heard, but our focus is through the lens of specific nonprofit partnerships. Does that make sense?
Right. Well, I guess my question is that an office like this could actually play something of a prophetic role in an area where we all of us, don't pay enough attention.
And I think we're trying to play that role, but in specific areas. I don't think that, you know, we're charged with, I guess, shouting from the rooftops about core issues, but instead focusing on the specific ways through either closing the mentoring gap in our country or increasing father involvement we can impact these problems. So there are other folks who do that, but I think there's a bit of a difference in our role there. And on the second issue, you know, I think we have in many ways very intentionally confronted the difficult legal issues related to this office. You know, I think one thing that folks kind of gloss over is the fact that we set up the advisory council and tasked a task force of that council with confronting many of those issues. Now, the religious hiring issue is something separate. It's something that, of course, we know people are very concerned about and that there's a tremendous public interest in, and it's something that we are very carefully and thoughtfully taking a look at. But I think the first piece can't be glossed over, that that through our advisory council and through the recommendations that they will put forth in just a few weeks, you know, they're going to take a hard look at some of the core legal issues related to this office, and we welcome that, and we did that very intentionally.
Yeah. I could go on, but I want to get to our audience. Let's start.
Hi, Josh. My name is Wilson Golden, and I'm with a traditional mainline Protestant church here in town, New York Avenue Presbyterian. Mm. And in addition to the great history going back 200 years, and a lot of presidents have come and gone over the years, and a traditional ministry, a couple of blocks from the White House, we do a lot of social action ministries, mm-hmm. many rooted in the civil rights and peace movements of the 60s. Dr. King was a regular visitor. And we have ministries around homelessness, youth mentoring, community club for D.C. schools, a socialization program. We host Habitat and a lot of other groups. How does a traditional church that sort of hosts and houses a very active social action ministry, in other words, not just a sort of focus group, yeah. how do we interact with your office?
Sure. Well, I think there's a number of key ways, but most importantly, through our agency center. So, for example, on your issues related to homelessness and housing, we have a center at HUD that's working on innovative partnerships around housing issues to connect that department with local nonprofits to have a greater impact on key issues. Mark, our center director, is here today, and they've done trainings, for example, across the country on helping local organizations and congregations help their members avoid foreclosure. And so, you know, I think it's about connecting to each of those agency centers and through the White House office as well. You can do that very simply through our website at whitehouse.gov/partnerships, which lists out all of those agency centers that you can connect with.
Rob?
Hey, Josh. Rob Maruse from Associated Baptist Press. And hey. Sorry for missing most of your speech, so maybe you've addressed this, but just in case you haven't, one of the legal issues that you have addressed in the council is probably the second most controversial issue, whether churches should form separate 501c3s. You had a closely divided council vote on that a couple of weeks ago. I just wonder, what is the administration plan to do with that advice, sure. Narrowly divided as it is from the council?
Sure. Well, we are actually concluding the process of finalizing that council report. So we are holding on sort of the administration's perspective on these issues and on moving forward on as many of those recommendations as we can until that report is submitted. So that will happen in the near future, and at that point we'll make a determination about what we can implement and what we can't.
Please, the lady in the red and white, or crimson and white.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. I'm interested when you said that your office will help nonprofits build capacity. I'm wondering what specifically you plan to do.
Sure.
Are you talking about CDBG funds that have been used over the years for operational expenses, or, you know, how are you going to build capacity?
Sure.
And then related to that, when you say you want to work in partnership to help nonprofits serve those in need, what does that mean?
By the way, could you identify yourself? I just want everybody to know who everybody is, unless somebody has reason to keep deep cover.
But, oh, yes, I have reason to keep deep cover. No. I'm Cheryl Buford, and I'm an independent consultant and doing a lot of work with Stanley at IRFA.
Thank you.
Great. On the first question about capacity building, the first and most important thing we're doing is really cataloging what the federal government is doing in the capacity building space and really trying to streamline that. What we found is that, you know, there are some big significant efforts at HHS, especially, and some at the Corporation for National Service that folks know about. But everyone from labor to the Forest Service is doing some sort of nonprofit capacity building, but it's not all in one place yet. And agencies aren't talking with one another about the funds and the support that's available there. So we have convened a new interagency working group on nonprofit capacity building to pull this all together in one place for the first time so that organizations can better know what's out there for them. So I think that's one important thing. We're also going to focus on specific efforts, the work at HHS, the Capacity Building Fund at the Corporation for National Service, and make sure where we can that those are supported. And think through, you know, as legislation emerges and as administration efforts move forward on service delivery, that where possible those efforts have a capacity building function as well. We don't want to just fund and support services, but also strengthen local nonprofits. In terms of the second question about what partnerships mean, well, yeah, I think that's what, you know, a lot of the points in the speech spoke to in terms of in specific issue areas, whether it's mentoring or public health or disaster response or interfaith cooperation, we're going to identify specific challenges and then take a creative approach to addressing those challenges.
By the way, Adele, do you want to come in at some point? Where are you? Do you want to come in now or later, or you can pass for now? Could you identify yourself to everybody else?
Adele Banks, Religion News Service. I'm wondering, as the director of the office, what you're hoping will come from those council recommendations, whether you expect there will be specific policy changes.
Sure.
Or just could you be as specific as you can about what happens?
Definitely.
Next?
Well, you know, I don't want to prejudge the final process, but what I do know is that it's been a very thoughtful process, one that's been sort of deeply involved and involving, and the issues that they've taken up are extraordinarily substantive, and we're going to take them very seriously. So we will look at what comes into us and then judge what we can implement and what things may pose more challenges. But again, it's something we're taking very seriously.
By the way, I think we had originally planned the timing of this meeting to come after those recommendations were given. So we were not trying to provide Joshua with a way of getting off the hook. but then, for some reason, the decision was made to postpone these. So that's
not
why.
Not because of this meeting. Yeah.
just wanted to, Father Tom Reese, if somebody will. And then, Mr. Coleman, you can take a mic right in front there.
Tom Reese from Georgetown University. Josh, your emphasis seems to have been on the delivery of service by churches and church-related organizations. There's a whole other advocacy side in terms of church organizations and some religious organizations whose principal function is advocacy. In other words, they want a place at the table. Mm-hmm. And determining not simply things that affect churches, but the poor, the war, et cetera, et cetera. What is the role of your office in in dealing with advocacy organizations that are church-related?
It's a good question. I would broaden our umbrella a bit beyond just churches to nonprofits, and that actually gives us a lot of room to work through partnerships with religious organizations and other nonprofits as well. But in terms of advocacy, that's really, in many ways, not the responsibility of our office, and it's important to draw that line for many reasons, for the sort of the legal footing of this office. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that religious leaders should not continue to have a significant voice in the public debates that are happening in our country and within the White House as well. The Office of Public Engagement makes sure that that voices are heard on a regular basis, and I think they've done a tremendous job at that as well. And we'll work, you know, in a separate capacity from this office to make sure that voices are heard. But in terms of our day-to-day work at the faith-based office and our affiliated agency centers, that's really focused on nonprofit partnerships.
Bill Coleman, a member of our board, distinguished public servant. Thank you.
Sir, I'm Bill Coleman. I'm a partner in a law firm in town.
Oh, wonderful.
Could you speak up, Bill, a little bit? Yeah, it's on. Just put it close to your mouth.
I'm a partner in a law firm in Washington, all over the world. One, I take it the law is pretty clear that there has to be a separation between church and state.
Mm-hmm.
For that reason, I take it if the federal government wanted to give $2 billion or $2 million to Notre Dame, it's probably be unconstitutional. But if instead there are 15 students that finish high school that apply for Notre Dame for admission, get admitted, they certainly have the right to take those student funds, and that would be constitutional. With respect to other things, if you have an entity created by a Catholic church, for example, but it's not limited to Catholics as far as the board, they could take money from the federal government, can't they?
Yes, I think the core focus, and there are folks, you know, there are lawyers across this room who could, including you, of course, who could speak to this in great detail, is on what's being done with the money, what services are being provided. And if the services are secular in nature, then, you know, there's a fair amount of flexibility for competing there. But we just need to make sure that the dollars are not going towards specific religious purposes.
And I just mentioned
what
that
I can say, thank God you gave me the money.
I just mentioned we're going to have a panel a little later in the day that will look specifically at the law and the specific legal issues, and that might also be of interest to you in terms of discussing these issues in more detail.
That's great.
Yeah, actually, after President Obama gave his speech at Notre Dame, Joshua found that pot of money and just they did get $2 million. you've heard that here first. Over there. Yeah, please.
Daniel Daughtry Weiss. I worked for about 10 years in the intersection between federal government and really small grassroots organizations serving the poor. And I guess I do have to disclose I currently work for Dare Mighty Things and the Compassion Capital Fund support, but I'm here on my own time. So my interest is a broader than that. My question is around there's sometimes been it's the faith-based office, and then there's this, as you say, this. It's not just the faith-based office. It's the faith-based community office or the faith-based and neighborhood initiative. And you're broadening, you're trying to make that more clear and things like that. In my experience, the most inspiring organizations that I've sat down with are these very, very small organizations with a few staff, maybe no staff, volunteer-run. To what extent is that connecting with those really grassroots, street-based organizations a focus of your office, regardless of whether they're religiously affiliated or not? I noticed in the last budget that the Compassion Capital Fund and the Strengthening Communities Fund at HHS, which fund very small, like $10,000 to $20,000 grants across the country, hasn't been funded, which, you know, that's a year-to-year decision. And that the other capacity building initiatives, we have NOFA, you mentioned as at the corporation, has grants that are a minimum of $100,000, which minimum, so average is probably going to be higher. And I just, has that played any role in your discussions around policy or?
Sure.
Could I make your question more pointed? Are you asking if they're moving away from those smaller capital
whether that's been intentional or just
yeah.
a fluke, I guess.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. You know, it's a very important question, and I think a real challenge and one that we're attempting to take on. There are some capacity issues that you know need to be worked through and that we'll be candid about. You know, we are a relatively small office in any office, and there are a lot of local nonprofits out there. And so we have to think about how to have maximum impact given the capacity that we have. And we can do that sometimes working through regional groups and national groups to make sure that information and resources flow down. Sometimes we can go to communities themselves, and we've done that as well. But other times it's about making sure that the capacity building support is there across government. And again, these are year-to-year funding decisions. But what we're hoping to do is, as I mentioned before, through regular service delivery funds across government, really make sure that agencies are thinking about and OMB is thinking about the need for capacity building to come alongside that service delivery. So that's a sort of a general answer. One is that I acknowledge the challenge from the perspective of the office and its day-to-day work, and two, that you know we're just going to keep pushing to make sure that capacity building is there where possible.
Could I press you on that? Because I think, and Mark Chavez is in the room, he's going to be on the next panel, that it's always been a problem in this area where lots of people were talking about the smaller grassroots groups saying, gee, these, you know, government always bypasses these, and we got to do more for them. And yet you run smack into the fact that many of these smaller groups, precisely because they're so small, cannot deliver services in any with any of the kind of efficiency, at least in principle, that larger groups can. Yeah. And you know, the commitment is there, the desire is there, but the capacity isn't. Could you talk about sort of how you a little more about how you've been thinking of this trade-off? Because I think it's a practical problem when you're dealing with government money, where the taxpayers don't want, in principle, love these groups, may if they heard about them, but wouldn't want money wasted on groups that really didn't have a lot of capacity to deliver the service.
Well, one helpful thing is that in terms of helping local nonprofits, smaller groups reach capacity, we're not the only ones out there that know how to do that and can do that. In fact, there are many organizations and entities that can help us with that work so that these groups can get up to capacity. One key part of our new interagency effort on capacity building is going to be to connect with the larger foundations and intermediaries and others who can work to sort of share the load and the burden of capacity building out there. So I think they're acknowledging that, you know, that there are other resources we can point to when government capacity building efforts aren't enough is one way to address that problem.
Please. Yes. Our colleague and friend, please tell everybody who you are.
Ricky Kramer, Frederica Kramer. I'm an independent consultant, but I've spent a lot of the last decade doing work on this at the Urban Institute. And I'm wondering, unless I missed it because I came in late, I apologize. This stuff is hard to do. Capacity building is hard to do. Partnerships are hard to do. We've had 50 years of trying to do that to the Great Society programs. And I've heard very little discussion of a research and evaluation strategy to know how to learn how to do this and learn how to replicate it. And I think the issues that are important, it seems to me, are on very many different levels. There are systemic effects. If you really were successful, there are huge systemic effects that could happen in local social service delivery systems that you need to know about, and whether they go in the right direction, the wrong direction, who gets served, who doesn't get served, and so forth. The partnerships themselves, as I've said, are hard to do. There's a history of that, but you need to attach it to some monitoring and thoughtful evaluation on what happens and what works. There are clearly constitutional issues. You talked about that. The question of whether how you evaluate that is a big one. And then the very big one, which has dogged many people in the field, is what makes for effective services, and that the question from that is then how do you replicate it not only across faith-based organizations but into the secular world so that you have models that in fact do serve the entire range. And I don't hear and haven't heard the impetus which could come from your office to both the agency centers and to the research offices into how you turn this into a learning process to build better programs. It was clear that I just want to say one more thing, that one of the problems with the prior administration's approach to this was not just the political, apparent political issue embedded in it, but that there was no evaluation associated with, for instance, sending out all the money for the small capacity grants. We don't know what happened with them.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Well, it's a very good question and one we spend a lot of time thinking about. In fact, just had a gathering of our center directors to think through how going into the next year we strengthen our process of monitoring and evaluation. There are a number of answers, and sometimes I gloss over this only because it's something that is such a core commitment of this president and sort of all of the proposals that he's moving forward through the budget and other areas that I forget to mention it. Take, for example, our new effort around fatherhood that we're working on with HHS. The whole focus of that budget proposal is on measuring what works and then bringing core models up to scale and making sure that the money is there to do that. So I think sort of issue area by issue area, as the president is proposing new programs, especially those that relate to our office, we're going to try to make sure that monitoring evaluation is embedded in that. And then we're also going to do our part through the non-financial and the civic partnerships that we create to count and number and measure those and then publicize them with greater transparency through our website, through annual reports, and so on and so forth. So, I think it is a challenge. It's one that we're willing to take on, but I can certainly assure you that it's something that we're focused on.
Thank you very much. Let's see, the gentleman over here on the right.
Hi, my name is Scott Gissendanner. I'm a political scientist at the University of Göttingen in Germany. Thank you, Joshua, for your talk. You were mentioning about capacity building, faith-based. And
could you hold the mic a little closer?
Yeah, you were talking about capacity building of faith-based and neighborhood initiatives. But there's a flip side of the coin there, to where if you have faith-based initiatives that have greater capacity, you also have the ability of using those initiatives in a governance capacity, and at the same time improving the capacity of the agencies of the United States government to fulfill their mission. You know, you talked about the H1N1 virus example, and also about using faith-based organizations to get input into a policy innovation process. To what extent is this a conscious effort in what you're doing?
Sure. It's very much a conscious effort, and it's something that we need to make sure to pause and do every time we're seeking to communicate information to local groups or resources and so forth. Make sure that we're also hearing from them about how we can improve our day-to-day operations. We're doing it in the capacity building field. We will do it in the international field as well. We're doing it now in terms of our coordination around the response to the Haitian disaster. So the short answer to your question is that it's something that we're very intentional about. We want to make sure that we're listening as much as we're talking, and you know we will err from time to time, but it's something that we're very much focused on.
Thank you. And the lady in the way in the back there. By the way, I want to welcome Mara Vanderslice, who's been working in this field for a long time and who's deputy director of the office, of the faith-based office. Welcome, Mara. It's good to have you. Ma'am.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Butler. I write a blog that has some faith and politics emphasis. I'm also a lawyer.
Again, I'm sorry, could you hold it closer to you?
Sure.
So we can hear
you. I'm a blog writer and one of those that you referenced, and I'm also a lawyer, so I have some constitutional.
That's really dangerous, a blog writer and a lawyer.
Yeah, that's a wild combination. And I'm a big fan of Father Reese sitting over here. Hi. My question is, I really liked that you were mentioning the international global direction that wasn't previously in the Bush administration. I was wondering if you were veering away from exclusively a sort of humanitarian and more of a an ideological, potentially, focus on this. Have you heard of the gentleman who thinks that you can undermine al-Qaeda, and he's written a book about this, in 24 months?
Me personally?
No, in 24 months, okay. if you label them a cult and attack their... Okay. Basically attack the legitimacy or authenticity of their Islamic beliefs. And there are organizations in the faith-based arena that are really involved in conflict resolution and from a religious understanding and perspective. And so my question is, what do you see in terms of the international focus being? Is it strictly humanitarian, like Haitian relief, or is it going to be something that can really undermine war? Because we know that, you know, that's one of our huge budget crisis challenges, right? And we need to get out of it. So is this a vehicle by which we could possibly move faith-based communities, because we're in wars that have some religious, ideological, purported, ostensible legitimacy, or that's if we have faith-based communities attacking that, is that something your office might move into in terms of the global reach?
Sure.
Well, another way to ask it is, why haven't you undermined al-Qaeda yet? Thank you for that question.
If I said we were working on it, people would take that too seriously. So, there are a couple things, major things that we're doing in the international space. One, we're bringing the same partnerships vision that I spoke to our center at USAID to focus on the development and humanitarian issues that you mentioned at the top. But then the second thing is not nearly as specific as what you're talking about there, but we do want to take a step back and work with the State Department, and this is something that Mara and myself and Ari Alexander and others have spent a lot of time on, to make sure that they and others across government are able to navigate important civic and religious issues abroad. And in many ways, the State Department and other entities, not just state, the White House, has not been able to think through religious issues and the relationship between religious institutions and actors in our diplomacy and our development. We want to think about that and think about a way to do that in a way that's constitutional and also effective as well. So it's much more general than the specific challenge that you pose, but that's what we're thinking about, is more from an institutional perspective.
Thank you. We got to cut it off, but we'll Melton, please, you can have the last question.
Thank you. Josh was hesitant to ask because we have an opportunity to visit on the task force, but this is not a question that I've ever posed to you, and, mm-hmm. and we haven't talked about it. Your sensitivities are so encouraging because you're sensitive to the separationist principle. You're sensitive to the whole matter of the way government and religious organizations intersect. You've been very careful today to say that you're working with members of the religious community, with people who are not related to religion. You've emphasized the neighborhood component, which is important. In some of the congressional hearings, there have been questions about the name of the office. And listening to you today just kind of brought all of that up again. Have you ever thought that the name of faith-based office might ultimately be counterproductive to what the office is trying to do?
Sure. It's a good question. And I would say that I'm very comfortable with the way that the office is both structured now and named as well. I think it's acknowledgement of the very important role that many faith-based organizations have all across the country in terms of meeting specific human needs, but also other neighborhood organizations, civic groups, other nonprofits. And I know that there are going to be some very sincere differences on this issue, and that framing and naming is important, but the president has never been one to deny, and in fact, he emphasizes the role of faith and values and the importance of faith-based organizations in our American life while acknowledging the other issues that you mentioned as well. So I know that there's going to be continued conversation about that, but I'm very comfortable with our name.
I was going to say, when you left, would I have to say thank you to the director of the Office of Community Initiatives after well asked. I want to thank Joshua Dubois. A lot of people have been working in this area, and there are many books in the Bible that might inspire people, but I think in this area, Job may be the most relevant book for someone doing this job. In that speech in 2006 that Joshua referenced, President Obama said that we were tired of hearing more screed than sermon. We didn't quite hear sermon today, although I'd love to hear that someday, but we definitely didn't hear screed. And I just really want to thank you, Joshua, for joining us today and for answering lots of questions. Thank you. Emily, can I ask you a question? We may be over a bit. Should we break or should we go straight to the next panel? Take 5 minutes, and then we'll get the next panel up here. And you can grab some more coffee. Greet Joshua. And if I could call you here, David Saperstein told me when we call the five-minute break that, of course, you know it's never a five-minute break. But if everybody could begin to, could actually not begin to, but actually take their seats so we could get moving here. That shows the authority I have. Let me try again.
Make an announcement about lunch.
No lunch for anybody who doesn't sit down now. How's that? Well, I'm just going to begin by introducing the panel, and we will pray that people will sit down. This is a very exciting panel, and it's a very exciting moment for me because I have been learning from Mark Chavez for a long, long time and never actually met him until today. You know, some people get excited about meeting Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt, Kanye, Bono. I'm excited to meet Mark Chavez. And then Melissa told me that sounds just like you. So I'm now playing to my stereotype. But Mark is a professor of sociology, religion, and divinity at Duke University. He's the author of many books, Congregations in America, Ordaining Women, Culture and Conflict in Religious Organizations. Very simply, Mark has done some some of the most important work, I think, in his area, particularly his national congregations study, looking at what congregations actually do in this area, what their capacity is. I think it's foundational research, and it's essential that anybody who cares about this area should look at it. Steve Monsma is a wonderful man whom I have had the pleasure of working here before. He is also a pioneer of research in this area. He's a senior fellow at the Paul Henry Institute for the Study of Christianity and Politics at Calvin College. It's actually nice to remember former Congressman Paul Henry, who was really an extraordinary member of Congress. He'd be totally at sea in this part of this polarized political environment. Actually, he was a moderately conservative Republican from that part of Michigan, and had extraordinary reach across party lines. Steve is also a non-resident fellow at the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor University. He's got a BA from Calvin, an MA from Georgetown, a PhD from Michigan State. He has also written a lot of books, including The Challenge of Pluralism, Church and State in Five Democracies. And here's one that whose title is totally appropriate to the moment: Faith, Hope, and Jobs. And then it's Welfare to Work in Los Angeles. But we want a new edition where you will conjure up about 6 million jobs for us. Steve, also Putting Faith in Partnerships, Welfare to Work in Four Cities, and a whole lot of other great work. Rebecca Sager, this is a very nice story. Rebecca Sager is a great scholar. I met her a couple of years ago when she was working on the Hill. Her thesis advisor happened to be Mark Chavez. And I think one of the reasons Mark showed up today is he got a kick out of being on the same panel with Rebecca today. She is the author of the hottest new book in this field, if I can put it that way, Faith, Politics, and Power, the Politics of Faith-Based Initiatives. It's on state implementation of the faith-based initiative. I guess it will be published this fall, it says here, but I've got it in my hand. So is this an old...
It's out. On Amazon.com.
Yes. It's a good book. I have it. She has published a number of pieces on this, and it is just great to have her here. And then as a respondent, we have respondents on both panels, and we are so grateful that Renata Cobbs Fletcher, who is Vice President for Youth Connections and Reentry at Private Ventures. On each panel, we wanted someone who has been in the trenches on the work that we are talking about, and Renata has done extraordinary work since joining PPV in 2003. She has worked on program design, technical assistance, capacity building on initiatives focused on improving the lives of people in disadvantaged communities. One of the largest of these, Ready for Work, is a national multi-state prisoner reentry demonstration projects aimed at reducing crime and recidivism, and she also has a long and distinguished career. I will just mention, since I'm mentioning everyone's books, she is the author of Mentoring Former Prisoners, A Guide for Reentry Programs, and co-author of From Options to Action, A Roadmap for City Leaders to Connect Formerly Incarcerated Individuals to Work. This is one of the most important issues in our society, and it's on that long list of important issues we do not pay enough attention to. So we are grateful for your work and grateful that you are here. So because I think of him as Angelina Jolie or Brad Pitt or Kanye, I'm going to ask Mark to open this up.
Thanks, EJ.
Punch that button.
Got it. Thanks, EJ. It's actually a little bit of a mixed feeling to be on the panel with Rebecca, because I'm nowhere near old enough to have a student who's a distinguished scholar in her own right and on a panel like this. But it's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to take my time to tell you about results from one very specific research project. Right, let me back up. I'm going to focus my attention on congregations, meaning local places of worship, churches, synagogues, mosques, and their role in this arena. That's what I know most about. That's what I study. So with that focus, I'm going to tell you about results from one very specific recent research project, and then I'm going to make two broader points. The recent research that I want to tell you about asked a very simple question. The question is, did the faith-based initiative as it's existed over the last 8 or 10 years, really, or 12, really, if you, depending on how, when you date it, did it have any noticeable impact on American congregations and their role in social services arena? Congregations, I sometimes in this arena feel a little self-conscious talking about local congregations because local churches are only one type of religious organization targeted by the faith-based initiative, and in a lot of ways they're not the most significant type of organization in our type of religious organization. Their significance, I think, pales in comparison to religious organizations dedicated to social services like Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services and Jewish Family Services and so on. But influencing congregations was, in fact, one of the goals of the faith-based initiative as it existed. They were ideologically important to the initiative. They were held up as kind of ideal type examples of local, holistic, personal, religiously based social services and organizations that were considered kind of the alternative to the current system. Local clergy were targeted by the faith-based initiative. They were invited to conferences and workshops and seminars and brochures, websites, guidebooks on how to apply for government grants were all focused on them. They were among the small and inexperienced community organizations that wound up getting money through Compassion Capital Fund. And they were the initiative also sought to encourage partnerships between other kinds of nonprofit organizations and government agencies and congregations. So it makes sense to ask, did all this activity have any impact on congregations, on local congregations? And of course, one of the core assumptions of the faith-based initiative was that there is this untapped energy, creativity, and resources lying dormant in congregations that could be available for mobilization by this initiative. So, did this activity change congregations? We can answer this question, by the way, because the National Congregation Study was first done in 1998, essentially year zero of the faith-based initiative, and we did it again in 2006 and 2007. So that's how I'm able to track change over kind of exactly the right time period. Did the faith-based initiative change? Yeah, really lucky just to have done that survey in 1998, and then all this happened. So the answer is yes and no. I'm an academic, remember, so we have two hands, and on the one hand this, and the other hand that. The congregation's interest in social services and in government partnerships increased over this period. More churches expressed interest in applying for government money. More did community needs assessments. More had a speaker from social service organizations. So the faith-based initiative got congregations' attention in various kinds of ways. Behavior, however, is another story. It didn't change. Not at all. There's no increase in congregation social service involvement. No increase in paid staff doing social services in congregations. No increase in the percent to receive government money. It was 3-ish% in 1998. It's 3-ish% now. By the way, it was 3-ish% in 1950 as well. That one of the myths of the faith-based initiative was that congregations couldn't receive government money, and that hasn't been true forever. There was no increase in collaborations between churches and government or nonprofits. There is one hint in the data that congregations that were already involved in this kind of work may have intensified their involvement in the work, which is, there's an irony there because, of course, one of the goals was to bring in the new kinds of organizations. But if it had any impact at all, it was intensifying the work of the organizations, the congregations that were already involved. But the data is not clear on that point. But if there was any behavior change, that was it. So the bottom line is that the faith-based initiative got congregations' attention, but had little or no impact on behavior. That's the punchline. So that's the specific research that I wanted to mention today, and you can see the report. A working paper version of this report is online on the National Congregation Study website. It'll appear in March in the Nonprofit and Voluntary Sector Quarterly, so if you want all the gory details, you can get them. Two broader points I want to make. First is that I think it's clear why the faith-based initiative had so little impact on congregations, and I think there is a lesson here for any future version of this initiative with respect to congregations, but probably broader as well. I think a fundamental problem was the flawed assumption that congregation-based social services represented an alternative to the current system. There really is no meaningful alternative system to be found in the religion world, in the religious world. Congregations long have occupied an important but limited place in community social welfare systems. And maybe more important, far from constituting an alternative to that system, congregation social service activity depends on it. It mainly exists in partnership by volunteers going to work at other organizations and so on. So to effect real change in our social welfare system, with this in mind, a knowledge-based, faith-based initiative should recognize that congregations already are part of social service delivery systems that include government agencies, large and small, religious and secular social service agencies. And there surely are ways to strengthen this system, but the faith-based initiative strategy of bypassing the existing system, redirecting resources from one to another part of it, and trying to build up one small part of it rather than building up the delivery network as a whole was not likely to achieve that goal. So I hope that, and from Joshua's comments this morning, it sounds like this is a lesson that's been learned. I hope that any future faith-based initiative wouldn't make those same mistakes of trying to bypass and imagining this alternative system that was out there. One final broader point, and this has to do with a kind of what I think congregations do have something very special to offer this overall system, I think. I think it gets overlooked. And I like to make a point because I spend so much time criticizing things. I like to say something positive and constructive.
This is Washington. You don't have to do that.
I felt the need over the last 8 years to constantly call attention to the limits of churches. Role in this system, but maybe now it's time to focus on what the other side, the glass half full. I think congregations are especially and maybe uniquely good at mobilizing small groups of volunteers to do well-defined tasks on a periodic basis. Small groups of volunteers, well-defined tasks on a periodic basis. The 8 people who'll cook once a week at the homeless shelter. The 12 people who will spend 8 Saturdays on a habitat rehab project. The youth group that'll spend 2 weeks in the summer painting a church. Small groups of volunteers, well-defined tasks on a periodic basis. The well-defined and periodic part is important because the broader point is recognizing the limits, the value and the limits of volunteer-based activity. So I'm nervous about open-ended mentoring programs because that's not well-defined. And there are cases of these programs that they fall apart precisely because the expectations are not well-defined and periodic. So I think the better way, making better use of congregations enhancing partnerships between congregations and government or nonprofit or other kinds of social service agencies means figuring out how to better use that particular kind of resource. Now, that's a lot less sexy than giving the money and all the other things, but I think that is actually if we're serious about enhancing partnerships with churches in particular, local congregations in particular, that's what they really do have to offer, I think. And it's no accident that the kinds of things the organizations that congregations most partner with are organizations like Habitat or like local homeless shelters, because those are the organizations that have figured out how to use exactly that thing that I think churches really do have to offer the system. So, you know, like Joshua said, that's not a headliner. I don't think there's any legal or constitutional issues at all in enhancing that. It's not controversial, I don't think. But I think that actually is the more realistic way to think about focusing attention if you care about enhancing congregations' role in all this. And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I was thinking the title of your talk is Much Ado About, and then fill in the blank, and we could talk about that as we go. Steve Monsma, it's great to have you here. Yeah, Steve and Mark have somewhat different points of view on this, which is one reason why we wanted them here, but they both do honest research, which is very helpful these days. Steve.
I'm going to go speak from the podium since I have some PowerPoint slides, which hopefully we can call up, which may hopefully will help in my...
If we have any expertise on this, if we need it. Somebody should dim the lights.
Okay, here we go. Okay. In my time, I would like to discuss what social science research is at least beginning to reveal in regard to whether or not faith-based programs are more effective in achieving the desired or hopeful outcomes among their program participants. Let me make three points. If I can make, well.
Do we have a PowerPoint expert in the room? I certainly am not one.
No. It should go to the slide number two, but it's not doing it. My first point. Oh, okay. I was going backwards instead of forward. Okay, so
we've got it up in heaven there somewhere.
Well, okay. We can go on. My first point is that fully accurate outcomes research is difficult to do. Some would say it's even impossible to do. And I could take the rest of my time this morning, you know, cataloging the challenges that good outcomes research faces. But suffice me to say that we are dealing with real people in the real world where it is next to impossible to duplicate the controls that one can have in a laboratory situation or even in a double-blind study such as is used in investigating a new drug. I would only add that this is hardly a unique situation when it comes to public policy making. But that leads to my second point, and this is the most important one. In general, and with some exceptions in both directions, participants in faith-based social service programs tend to have somewhat better outcomes than do participants in comparable secular social service programs. This was a conclusion that Robert Fishew reached in his delightfully entitled paper, In God We Trust, All Others Bring Data. He carefully examined 18 published peer-reviewed empirical studies that compared the outcomes of faith-based and secular programs. He concluded, quote, the overall effect of faith-based and community programs, although modest in size, demonstrates that these programs tend to produce somewhat better outcomes compared with usual services, secular services, or no special programming. The spectacularly better outcomes that anecdotal accounts of faith-based programs having compared to government or other secular programs, frankly, tend to melt away when programs are subject to careful empirical analysis. However, faith-based programs do tend to have slightly better outcomes than their secular counterparts, but often not at statistically significant levels. Let me give a few examples of programs which may help to illustrate this basic point. For example, there was a minority adult flu vaccination program in the San Francisco Bay Area, which involved 15 churches where the vaccinations were actually given at church, and 80% of the target adult minority participants in this study, 80% of them obtained the flu vaccine. The comparison group, only 46% did. I think a little later on we're going to hear more about the Ready for Work Prisoner Reentry Program. But here again, especially at the three-year level, which is hiding behind EJ there, the faith-based and some community providers tended to have lower recidivism rate than the national average, although not by a great deal. An example where faith-based programs had significantly worse outcomes was a California welfare-to-work study done by David Campbell at UC Davis. There, the faith-based providers had a 41% success level, that is, persons being employed at the end of the program, versus non-faith providers at almost 80%, although Campbell points out that among the faith-based providers, they tended to have participants in their program that had more severe challenges, such as substance abuse problems, being ex-offenders, et cetera, than was the case among the non-faith-based providers. Two examples of studies that I have conducted where outcomes were mixed or faith-based programs had, you know, slightly better outcomes. Welfare-to-work program in Los Angeles, the book that EJ mentioned earlier, there were really no significant differences in employment outcomes, except the for-profit providers did have significant, you know, even statistically significant better outcomes. Faith-based providers were better, however, in terms of participants who already had a job being able to hold on to those jobs 6 months later at about a 90% level, whereas for all of the groups, secular, government, secular, nonprofit, faith-based, it was only at about the 75% level. Again, you see there's a difference, but not a huge difference. I was involved in a study for the Department of Labor of a program for at-risk and adjudicated Latino youth in five Western cities. Again, there were no really statistically significant differences between faith-based and secular providers. And some of the faith-based providers, by some outcome measures, they did a bit better. Others, the non-faith-based providers, the secular nonprofits, did somewhat better. These are illustrations of the basic point that I started out with. My point number two, in general, and with exceptions, participants in faith-based social programs did slightly better than those in government programs and other secular programs. This leads to my third point, that is, based on social science outcomes research, there is no basis either to exclude or to favor faith-based providers in government partnerships. There may be other reasons, but in terms of outcomes, social science outcomes research, there's no basis either to exclude them or to favor them. Persons attending faith-based programs experience roughly the same level of positive outcomes as do persons attending the programs of secular providers. Therefore, the all-hands-on-deck approach for which President Obama has called means there is no reason to exclude faith-based programs from partnerships, and I'm thinking they're largely of financial partnerships with government. They have at least as much to contribute in providing services desperately needed by many in our society as do their secular counterparts. And here I want to make reference to the 6 million children that EJ mentioned earlier, that it's expected will live in poverty throughout their childhood. In a way, this is the ball that we need to keep our eye on. Those who are in desperate need in what is probably the richest society in the history of the world. That's a continuing tragedy and scandal, I would suggest. And as we attempt to deal with that tragedy and that scandal, whether it's children in poverty or others who are in desperate need, an all-hands-on-deck approach is clearly needed. And to me, from social science research, that indicates this needs to include faith-based organizations of a wide variety of types, but also government-run programs, secular for-profit, and yes, even for-profit programs, which also can be affected. Well, thank you. I'm not sure how to get rid of this, but.
Do you mind if I just shut it off?
No, that's fine.
That would do it, I think. I guess you. I think
Of course, we couldn't get it going. Now we can't get it to stop.
We can do okay. We'll have. Can we have the lights back? And yeah, there you go. I think. It's off. Good.
Oh, okay.
Rebecca, it's so good to have you here. Rebecca, really, Mark has sort of been able to replicate his survey. Rebecca's is really one of the only, or maybe the only, full-scale book on this subject since the change in administrations, and really a book that could look back at the whole of the Bush experience. So we're really grateful that you're here.
Right, and what I'm going to talk about is really about the Bush experience and about what happened at the state level. So while most of what we talk about when we talk about the faith-based initiative is focused on the federal level, I really want us to think a little bit about what's been happening at the state level. Since 1996, nearly every state has implemented some aspect of the faith-based initiative, from creating sort of new state faith-based bureaucracies to passing a variety of faith-based laws. The vast majority of states have actively been pursuing their own version of the initiative. States had to do this in an often kind of haphazard manner with little in direction, funding, or support from the federal government. And so they relied largely on what was happening in other states and had to kind of model what they were doing and what they saw around them. In this talk, I'm going to use data collected on all state faith-based administrative and legislative practices until 2007. And I'm going to very briefly try to sum up 6 years of work in 7 minutes, examining what states did to implement. What states did to implement the initiative, why these actions really didn't have much of an impact, and what states might consider doing next to create a better faith-based initiative. When the initiative first began in 1996, two main states took charge, marking out two very clear and very different paths. The first path was laid out in Texas under then-Governor George Bush. The focus in Texas and later in the Bush White House was largely on implementing faith-based policies that would change government culture and the political environment to be friendlier and less restrictive to faith-based groups. Then-Governor Bush did this in Texas through eliminating regulations for just faith-based organizations, creating few guidelines for these groups to follow while about church-state separation while performing social services, and mandating a change in government culture that was really about creating connections between faith and government and making this a much more kind of what he thought would be a friendlier environment, a more welcoming one. The hope, which Mark has also talked about, was that once these restrictions were lifted, overtly sectarian groups, especially congregations, would become more involved in the social service sector. So it was sort of, let's stop doing this, let's make this more welcoming, friendlier, and these groups will start coming to us. And as Mark has said, that really, unfortunately, did not happen. The second path to implementation states could have followed is the model begun in New Jersey around the same time. New Jersey's path to implementation offers a stark contrast to what happened in Texas. In New Jersey, not only were significant amounts of funding directed through their faith-based office to help already proven both faith-based and community-based organizations do social services, but they backed up this funding with clear guidelines regarding church-state separation, transparency about which groups received money and why, and engagement of community groups, not just faith-based organizations. And while there was still a focus on changing government culture to be more welcoming, this was not followed by special deregulation for these groups or special engagement of them to do social services. Since 1996, and these two early actors set out two possible roadmaps, states to varying degrees, by and large, followed the model established in Texas and the White House, a model that was more about using symbolic faith-based policy for political gain and blurring church-state separation rather than offering funding to proven groups to help the needy. Following this path, states by and large relied on three main symbolic types of implementation. While politically expedient and useful, did not do much to help FBOs or serve those in need. First, the most common activity was for states to create an Office of Faith-Based Initiatives or a faith-based liaison. Modeled after the ones in Texas, these officials worked with faith-based groups in their communities and relevant government officials to enhance cooperation. When I interviewed 30 of the 33 liaisons working between 2003 and 2005, I found that most liaisons were very religious and had come to this position because they wanted to. They wanted to create these connections and but really help faith-based groups do social services better. And they came in with a lot of high hopes for the initiative. They worked hard to make something happen, but they soon found there was little or no money, and the strong and the political support for what they were doing was really just not very non-existent. And so over time, these hopes faded away. I know that we've tried to move kind of away from the money question, but all the liaisons I spoke with told me that to do much of anything, whether long-term or periodic, whether with faith-based groups or with community groups, you need money. Money that is given out under clear rules that respect legal boundaries. As one liaison who I saw over this period for several years told me, where's the money? How are we supposed to do anything if we don't have any money? The sense that they were set out on a mission without the tools to succeed led to a growing frustration that the only people who seemed to gain much from the initiative were the politicians who gained political goodwill from the faith community. By 2009, of the 30 I had spoken with, only two were still faith-based liaisons. Almost all of them had left because of this growing frustration. The second most common way states implemented faith-based initiatives was to enact a variety of different types of faith-based legislation. Between 1996 and 2007, 42 states enacted over 270 different types of faith-based laws. Again, this legislation offered little in the way of new funding. Instead, these laws were more focused on loosening rules for faith-based groups and increasing their access and presence in government. Finally, states also supported conferences aimed at increasing public awareness around the initiative. However, as David Kuo has pointed out, these conferences also served as political rallying grounds for its political supporters and were used to quote court voters for politicians that spoke at these conferences. Because each of these three steps required little in the way of actual money, but generated much in the way of publicity and early public support for the initiative, and politicians at the state level could, to put it bluntly, get all of the faith-based bang without a lot of the buck. This emphasis on politics over policy has been that there's been, as Mark again pointed out, no significant increase in the numbers of partnerships between faith groups and the government, and no significant increase in the number of congregations doing social services. So what now? How do we move forward to create a better faith-based policy? I see three steps to move forward. First, state and local officials need to have the resources to take a look at what's already happening in their community. What connections are already being made? Who is doing what? What can the faith-based groups and their communities actually do? Because state actors had no funds, most states did not even take this first step and often ended up repeating actions already being taken or stepping on toes. Second, we need to take time to listen to the faith-based community. They have their ear to the ground and know what is needed. Instead of telling groups that they should become active or telling them what kinds of things they need to do, we need to spend more time listening to them and what their needs are. And again, most of them have said what they need is fiscal help to do things under clear guidelines to help the poor and needy that they see, especially now, needing more and more services from the churches that are really being stretched too thin. As one liaison said, we need to get these groups off their knees and onto their feet, and the only way to do this is money. And finally, we can all learn from faith-based groups about what works and how to repeat those actions over time. We can then offer real assistance and clear guidelines to help them succeed in their missions. In one of the last interviews I did, the liaison said that he told me while he saw many problems with the initiative, he cautioned, "Let's not throw the baby out with the baptismal water." Continuing to follow similar patterns in implementation that offer little immaterial concrete help, but much in symbolic political and policy development will only damage relationships between faith and government sectors. The faith-based initiative works best in states like New Jersey when these groups are engaged by government in a way that helps them facilitate their goals through funding assistance that is done under concrete and easy-to-understand guidelines. Many of these groups want to continue partnering with government, and there are, I'm hoping, some new ones who want to do this. And by focusing on what they need, rather on what they can donate in the way of political capital, is the first step forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I was thinking the title of that paper could be Mammon as God's Essential Ally. I also want to thank our first presenters, and I'm going to say this after Renata speaks, I'm sure. One of the reasons we wanted to put this panel together is that this debate has so often been a fact-free zone. And I'm grateful to all our participants for putting different sorts of very useful data and information on the table. And Renata, welcome, and it's great to have you. And for many of you know, PPV is one of the pioneers in this area, has done great work for a very long period of time.
Thank you very much. If you just give me a second, I'm a bit afraid of the PowerPoint here, so I may just do without it if I can't get it set up. Okay, great. Okay, there we go. Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much. As EJ mentioned, PPV has been engaged in faith-based work for some time. I have been with PPV for about 7 years, and the bulk of that work has been on the Ready for Work initiative that was mentioned earlier. So I do have, I think as someone mentioned earlier, a lot of the sort of on-the-ground experience in terms of working with the faith-based office, with the faith office of the Department of Labor, et cetera. So I think PPV brings a unique perspective, and I'm not going to focus so much on Ready for Work because I think some of our background is important. Okay, and I'm going to skip some of this that I think it has been covered. I'm just going to jump right to PPV's faith-based work, a lot of that led by John DiIulio. PPV essentially began its work in the mid-1990s with the question focused on learning of whether or not and how small to mid-sized faith-based and religious organizations could provide solutions to urban problems. And we've heard a lot today just about poverty and some of the intractable issues. And this idea came up because those issues were not being solved. And one of the things you hear often in communities is all that's left standing are the liquor stores and the churches. So really identifying strategies for leveraging the services of faith-based organizations. The first initiative was called Community Serving Ministries, and out of that came two of PPV's signature faith-based projects, the first being Youth Education for Tomorrow, which is a literacy program, an after-school program for children. The second being the Amachi program, which is a mentoring program for children of prisoners, and the child care initiative kind of never got seated at PPV. We went on with the faith-based work to launch Faith in Action. I'm just going to go through these very quickly. The National Faith-Based Initiative for High-Risk Youth, which was a mentoring program that partnered us with the Department of Justice and sought to impact outcomes for at-risk and high-risk juveniles. The Ready for Work demonstration project that we've talked about saw a lot of very promising outcomes for that specific to job placement, job retention, recidivism, as Stephen mentioned earlier. And lastly, some really strong correlations between participants who were mentored, both on the juvenile and the adult side, their recidivism rates and their ability to get jobs and stay in those jobs. So a lot of promise there, and I think a lot of the early work that John and others drove at PPV really, you know, resulted in Ready for Work, and I'm going to talk about that. Religion and values, and then finally the Bush-Clinton-Katrina Fund grant program, and we basically designed and administered that program specific to faith-based organizations and their recovery after Katrina. So through this work, we sought to answer several questions. Whether faith-based organizations can radically expand the recruitment, retention, and mobilization of volunteers for social programs, and why or why not? Can FBCOs provide a higher level of service than secular organizations or larger FBOs? And finally, the circumstances under which small local faith-based organizations could effectively implement programming. And we did and didn't answer some of these questions, so I'm going to get to that. We also had an interest in looking at the role of faith in programming, the capacity of faith-based organizations, and I'm really anxious to talk about that. There's a lot of questions I think are relevant to our work. Whether faith-based organizations were successful at attracting participants, if so, what type of participant, and the reasons why or why not. So I'm going to just jump to, you know, the early 1990s. And with that as a context, and again with John DiIulio driving the work, we looked at a program called the Youth Violence Reduction Partnership that was largely based on the Boston 10-point miracle led by the Reverend Eugene Rivers. And it was a juvenile project that specifically reduced or at some point eradicated completely homicides among juveniles in Boston. But when Philadelphia and PPV sought to recreate that through the Youth Violence Reduction Partnership, at that time, again, the early 90s, they deemed that there was not a faith-based organization within the city of Philadelphia that had the capacity to really pull off managing as a lead organization per the design of the YVRP. I'd say from that, starting with 2003 and Ready for Work, and a little before that with the National Faith-Based Initiative, which also, again, partnered us with the government, that PPV began to explore whether or not there were other ways for some of these smaller and mid-sized groups to be able to effectively deliver programming. And that meant for us, ideally, through PPV serving as an intermediary, providing comprehensive capacity building and technical assistance. And I think largely, at least with the work that PPV conducted, much of the work under the Bush administration over the 8 years that he was in office did sort of focus on that model of the smaller FBCOs, you know, having capacity building and having stronger and bigger organizations and intermediaries kind of help them develop. PPV's work really designed largely with Ready for Work and other initiatives to build stronger organizations that ideally would become more sustainable after we kind of pulled out, and thus those organizations would be able to receive direct funding. So PPV actually served as an intermediary and refunded many organizations that, as was talked about earlier, would not be qualified for funding directly from the federal government. A lot has been said earlier just about the volunteers, and I'd say PPV's work really underscores what's been said, that we have found that FBOs can add tremendous value to recruiting, retaining, and mobilizing volunteers. One of our findings also includes the fact that FBOs have been very successful at recruiting volunteers specific to serving kind of the most at-risk populations. So looking, for example, at children of prisoners, looking at Ready for Work that had a tremendous number of male volunteers recruited successfully for that program, and moreover, males of color. And with mentoring programs in particular, you know, as most of you all know, attracting adequate numbers of male volunteers to serve as mentors, and moreover, males of color, is quite a challenge for organizations. And we found that by the faith-based organizations sort of working through the congregations to, you know, come out on the pulpit and pull in men and women to volunteer, that proved to be a very successful strategy. Reentry, I'll just talk a little bit about, because I think, you know, in my opinion and some of the talk about different types of programs that we hear about, with my vantage point of reentry, it's somewhat unique in terms of needing for a number of program components to all be taking place at the same time, has a demand for a strong level of partnership between public and private partners. And I think what I have seen over the course of the last 7 years that I've been with PPV is that when when we started with Ready for Work, there was a lot of reticence, I'd say, from, you know, for example, jails letting in mentors to go and recruit for the program. Reticence of, you know, city governments wanting to partner with faith-based organizations. And I'd say from sitting here now that a lot of that has changed. And when you look at the Second Chance Act, RFPs, for example, that are coming out and that are articulating reentry strategies, you see sort of solidly there the faith-based community as a partner. And I think that's been a big step over the course of the last few years. We found that the faith community can be successful with the Juvenile Justice Committee, the Juvenile Justice Community. Some of our early findings suggested that many of the faith-based organizations that we've worked with in the past had some difficulty distinguishing between at-risk and high-risk youth, two very different populations with different needs, and the early research there indicated potentially that that needed to be sharpened in order to serve more effectively. Finally, that FBOs are not homogeneous, and we've, you know, I don't want to preach to the choir here, but a lot of my work over the last 7 years, you know, was sort of battling against the notion of one type of faith-based organization, you know, generally coming to mind the small, you know, mom-and-pop storefront church. And what we found was, you know, as you all know, just a range from, you know, a Catholic Charities or a Goodwill, you know, to the mom-and-pop shop, but a huge range in between of capacity. And what we feel we kind of contributed to Ready for Work and other projects was an ability to provide technical assistance that really took into account the culture and the structure and size of those organizations. And I think that's important for us to keep in mind. Another lesson learned is that with support, FBCOs can and do comply with the no proselytization rules. And there, I'd have to say, we were very careful, as was the federal government, in terms of ensuring, particularly because we had a mentoring component, that, you know, we were steering clear of any intrusion into government federal guidelines. And I'd say, you know, initially coming in, there was a lot of concern on our part that, you know, people would not comply. They did comply. I'd say, again, there a lot of our technical assistance work was around working with groups who did not want to feel that somehow by not proselytizing they were compromising their values or mission. And I think we came out of that really with most of the groups having an understanding that, you know, or figuring out a way to sort of live their faith rather than trying to convert a mentor. So I think that's an important piece. The religious orientation of an FBCO will not interfere with its recruitment of participants from other religions as long as there is no proselytization. As with secular programs, effective programming alone does not make for successful outreach. And, you know, part of PPV's work is really looking at recruitment strategies and those recruitment strategies that work. Talked a bit about technical assistance, and here I'd say we strongly believe that quality technical assistance and capacity building are crucial to the success of small to mid-sized FBCOs, and I think we found that to be true in the National Faith-Based Initiative Ready for Work and Yet. And I talked about the Youth Violence Reduction Partnership, and again, PPV's kind of growth in this field from that point of really trying to figure out how to work with those organizations. We feel there's still a lot to learn and, you know, are really excited about this new administration and the you know, sort of continuance of the faith-based office. A lot of questions have not been answered, and as someone said earlier, many of the programs not evaluated. So, unfortunately, there's a lot that we don't know about what worked and what didn't work. And I would definitely argue that some of the things did work, but unfortunately, were not evaluated. We don't know necessarily what role faith plays in effective service delivery. Talked a bit about effectiveness at service delivery. We feel that question is ultimately unanswered. Need to know what the differences are in effective service delivery between FBOs and secular CBOs of the same sizes and whether or not there are unique contributions that FBOs can make. Are FBOs more effective with specific populations? If so, how and why? And then to the sort of capacity building question, because I'd say, again, looking at the Bush administration, you know, there were a lot of different capacity building, you know, Dare Mighty Things, I know, provided some technical assistance. We served as an intermediary. A lot of different types of strategies that I think were not necessarily measured, as someone pointed out. And so we feel there's a tremendous opportunity kind of going forward with this administration to evaluate both the programs, but also the approach to capacity building. And look at really what types of capacity building are most effective for which types of organizations. We need to inform the public about how or if capacity building or technical assistance can lead to sustainable change. And again, really looking to build organizations that ideally become fundable and sustainable and effective going forward. We wonder what type, dosage, and frequency of technical assistance is most effective, and whether high-quality program replication among FBOs necessitates ongoing technical assistance or should end at some point. So we hope to definitely be a part of sort of the exploration going forward and are excited to be here. I do want to just say a quick thank you to John DiIulio, you know, both for his work at PPV, but also his generosity this past week and beyond, really just in terms of reflections on what we're talking about today. One of our next steps going forward is to work with John on a PPV publication that will look at PPV's work, you know, both in the context of the government partnerships, but beyond that, and also articulate more fully some of the lessons that we think stand to be learned. We will continue with our ongoing technical assistance work, which we work with FBOs sort of going forward. And really, as I talked about with the capacity building, hope that the government might consider at some point future demonstration or research projects that get to the bottom of all of the questions that we have. So that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I must say, those were spectacular presentations. Thank you so much, Renata. I was sitting here with the hope that after 10 years of beating each other's brains out about this subject, we might actually be entering a period when we could take a quiet look at what works, what doesn't, and try to do what works. And I like the spirit of all the presentations, because I think that was at the heart of the entire discussion. I want to ask a quick question to each of you, and it's all in the spirit of how do we figure out what works and how to go forward. Mark, I wanted to ask you, your earlier survey, I always thought, had an interesting finding which pointed to, and we talked about a little this morning, some of the problems politically President Bush had with this. Because if you looked at your earlier survey, the congregations that most wanted government help to do their work, they tended to be African-American and Latino congregations, not other kinds of congregations. They also tended to be more liberal or moderate congregations than conservative congregations. And so you ended up with a disconnect where the political base of the president did not lie in those congregations, so that the program, in principle, would be most popular in parts of the religious world where he was least popular and where there might be most skepticism of what he was up to. What I wanted to ask you, and maybe I'll just ask all four questions, and and then let you interact, and then we'll go to the audience. Did you notice any change in any of those core findings over the two surveys, and do they have any political meaning? To Steve, political, I mean not in the electoral sense, but in how we proceed on this. To Steve, on the faith-based outcomes, it struck me from the research I've seen that it is, in the end, very hard to decide whether FBOs are more effective than more secular organizations. I had a student who did a great study of the VA, which had faith-based and non-faith-based programs, and she looked at two dimensions. One was faith-based, non-faith-based. The other was whether the programs had heavy veteran involvement or not. What she discovered, which doesn't surprise us when you hear it, is the two groups of programs, faith-based, non-faith-based, were about equally effective or ineffective, and actually the variable that mattered was how heavily involved veterans were. And in the programs, the faith-based with veterans were very good. The non-faith-based with veterans tended to be good. It wasn't uniform, but that was the thrust. And so there's part of me that thinks the whole question of looking at which are more effective may lead us down a blind alley unless we can figure out, is there something very specific that faith-based groups can do that other groups can't? And what in the world would that be? And that is sort of my question to Renata as well, which is, while you say we need more research in this area, researchers, all of us, always want more research in the area. I'm curious what your findings are. And on Rebecca, and this really squares with Mark's presentation, in the end, it seems it doesn't matter whether you're for faith-based or non-faith-based programs. What matters is how many resources are you willing to put into programs that help the disadvantaged. And if you put in a lot of resources with the idea that faith-based groups won't be discriminated against, they'll do well. And if you don't put in many resources, no matter how much you talk about faith-based groups, they're not going to be able to do very much. And I just want you to talk about that research issue. So if we could go down the panel, and also please feel free to interact with each other's presentations.
So the specific answer is that all those patterns still exist now. The black churches are way more interested in this than white churches. Liberal churches are more interested in that. All those. However, that I mentioned that the interest in this kind of work and in government partnerships has increased, and that has increased among all the groups as well. So the differences are still there, but the increases are there across the board. Yes.
Was there any increase, greater increase
in some groups than others? Like, were conservative churches, because of the administration's emphasis, more interested at the end of all of this or not?
I don't think so, but I'm not sure. I don't think so. I remember. I know for sure that there was increase in all of them. I don't know that I had the statistical power to detect differences in the slopes of those lines. All the lines go up. It's unclear whether the slopes of the lines are different, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Steve?
Maybe just a couple comments. I think one distinction it's important to keep clear in our minds is between the work that churches or congregations as religious congregations are doing, which is what Mark has focused on in his research, versus what religiously affiliated or religiously based 501c3 nonprofit organizations are doing, which I have focused on more. And I think it's important to remember that both of those are out there. When we're talking about faith-based initiatives, we're talking about much more than what congregations are doing. We're also talking about faith-based organizations that are 501c3 nonprofit organizations. And in fact, from my general observations, they are the larger and more important players in this whole mix. The other point I would make, and this comes out of this study of at-risk and adjudicated Latino youths in five Western cities, where we did find there were significant differences, was between what we were able to call comprehensive programs. You know, we visited all of these sites, we did focus groups of the participants, et cetera, and it became clear to me as we did these that some of the programs really were very comprehensive. There was the government-funded program, but then there was also they would attempt to hook the youth into a whole range of other programs. You visited these sites, there'd be youth just kind of hanging out, playing video games or ping pong. They would take them out to sporting events. They would, if they were faith-based, they would invite them to youth groups at an affiliated church, et cetera. Others of these programs tended to offer, you know, perhaps a class in anger management, for example, that would last for 6 weeks, meet twice a week in the evening, and that would be largely the extent of the program. Well, when we compared the non-comprehensive with the comprehensive program, suddenly there were statistically significant results. Those comprehensive programs that were creating for these youths that came out of very poor neighborhoods, often poorly performing schools, they sort of created what these youths themselves sometimes called a second family, or what I would call a counterculture to the culture of the streets where many of them anyway had grown up. And they were doing much better in terms of education, in terms of employment, et cetera. So perhaps the question we should ask is not so much faith-based versus secular, but more the nature of the program, whether offered by a secular organization or a religious organization.
Thank you.
Rebecca.
AJ, you just said resources matter. So how much funding is actually out there that these groups can apply for, faith-based or secular, is obviously really important. I mean, if they feel like they're, you know, if states are running dry of funds, federal governments are running dry of funds, then none of these groups are going to be able to get the help out there to do the things that they need to do. I think that there are, you know, relatively small, easy to accomplish ways to help some of these groups do really important things. I mean, churches, for example, like we were periodic based helping with food. As we know right now, food insecurity in this country is a very big problem. 1 in 6 people are on food stamps. Why are we not doing more to help churches, which are really the first responders when people are hungry, when they go to a church to get food from a food pantry, when that food pantry runs dry? Why isn't there more work between the government and these churches to do things like get those groups food so people can go immediately to that church and get that help? I think one thing that people could be doing is identifying, and this goes back to the first step that I was talking about, which groups in the state or community level are doing things that actually work. Which groups are the best at doing what they do, community or faith-based, and then creating partnerships with other groups that are maybe ready to take that next step but don't have anyone to mentor them, don't have anyone to show them what to do, don't have anyone to, you know, tell them what it means to set up a board of directors, tell them what it means to set up their own separate 501c3, and making those connections so maybe those groups can go take that next step. But again, if there's not the money out there to help them do that, then they can't take that next step. So,
thank you. And, Renata, could I piggyback a question to you on this? You mentioned that I think maybe it was Gene Rivers' original line that in many of our neighborhoods, the church and liquor store are the only institutions left standing. When you said that, I thought maybe we should will soon have an Office of Liquor Store and Neighborhood Partnerships. But it raises the question, there are in some of our poorest neighborhoods and perhaps particularly African-American neighborhoods, the critical social and political role played by the churches might suggest that they have a role to play in those neighborhoods that might not be the case in other neighborhoods. And what are we to make of that? Does that, should that have any effect on the way we make policy or how we look at what works?
Okay. I would totally agree with you. I mean, I think it's a strategy in terms of the African American and Latino communities that we'd be very short-sighted, you know, not to leverage as a tremendous resource. Those are, you know, as folks have mentioned, the people who are in the trenches and know the communities that they're serving. So I think there's great value. I mean, I would distinguish between, you know, making a choice between the FBOs or the congregations being sort of the strategy, but rather kind of a piece of the puzzle, the entire puzzle. And I think that's an important distinction. Did you want me to answer the other, the initial question? Okay, and that was sort of what the data suggests around what the unique contributions are of faith-based organizations. And I'd have to say, first and foremost, I don't think we have data to support what those are. I do think just within, you know, I have my own inklings about it. You know, if you ask with different programs, different people at PPV, you'd get completely different answers about what the unique contributions are, which really leads me to believe that it depends on the type of programming. So, for example, the after-school literacy program, you know, I think we would all agree there that faith does not play a role. I feel very strongly for the reentry and would be very interested in measuring this at some point, that faith does, in fact, play a strong role. I think often the faith community brings with it a sense and a belief in the transformation of people, and I think that does sort of lend itself very well to prisoner reentry programs. And so I'm convinced, sort of without the research to back it up, that programs like that are, in fact, strengthened by the faith element.
One quick thing, Mark, I'd like you to put this on the record because we talked about it at breakfast, that people forget that we act as if these programs operate separately one from the other. And you were talking about how most programs, whether faith-based or secular, are actually surrounded by a fairly rich infrastructure of different of government and secular not-for-profit and faith-based, and they tend to work in tandem. And if we don't think of them that way, we are not thinking straight about how these work. Could you talk about that?
Sure. So the point was, I said it as a one-liner earlier, that far from thinking that church-based services are an alternative to the current system, their activity actually depends on their partnerships with the system. And the kind of my favorite example of that is the churches that worked on that fed people who needed to be fed in Tucson, Arizona, where I used to live. And actually, I think Rebecca worked on this project. There were, I think, 10 churches in Tucson. They were the only places that people who needed to eat for free could go. So the churches were a very important part of that system. And first you look at it and you say, oh, this is – it was great. But then you look closer and you found that so the churches were a very important part of the system. They provided the space. They provided volunteers to ladle the soup. All the food came from the Community Food Bank, which is a secular nonprofit organization. The city of Tucson gave a grant to hire a bus driver to deliver the food from the food bank to each church that was doing the feeding. They took turns on different nights of the week. So it just immediately just makes the point that the church's role in this just depends on the partnerships with the, in this case, the local city government and the secular nonprofit. Of the 10, I believe one of the churches actually was fully on its own. So it does happen that churches sometimes do it completely on its own. But 9 of the 10 were just part of this larger system. That's what I have in mind when I say that the church activity mainly depends on – they're already part of this system. They're not an alternative to it.
Thank you very much. We have a bunch of hands going up, and I want somebody to advise me on what kind of time we have, because I think we fell behind schedule a little bit. Wait, hold on just a sec. I'll bring you in. What I'd like to do is maybe bring in several comments all at the same time so we could get you in and then have the panel respond to you all. If you could – how much time do we have? 10? Oh, good. We're better off than I thought. That's good. Well, let's go over to this gentleman right here. Your name again is?
Daniel.
And then to this lady near the window, and then we'll go back to that lady in the back.
Just something to underscore what Mark just said, which is a lot of the food banks actually get commodities from the USDA. So that's another level of involvement in the system.
Thank you. Ma'am.
Hi, I'm Joanne Schneider, University of Maryland College Park, and director of the Faith and Organizations Project, which basically started out from the premise that Mark started with, which is that what you really need to look at is that system, the relationship between faith communities and those organizations. And one of the things that came out of this, or there's 3 points I want to raise very quickly. One, the real role of faith communities is not just volunteers, etc. The most important is governance, providing board members, providing guidance, and then all of the access to all these other things like the volunteers, the in-kind, etc. The second is that the major concern I have is the focus still on congregations when congregations as a faith community are appropriate for mainline Protestants, African Americans, peace churches, some evangelicals, but you need to focus on Archdiocese Order for Catholics, Federation for Jews, etc., and increasingly for evangelicals, networks that are not related to any congregation. And third, that yes, the faith is there, but it's not, you know, praying and doing all of these forefront things for most of the organization is doing that. So that said, I wanted to ask all the panel to think about how would you redesign policy to really focus on that system, okay, and strengthen that system?
That's a great question. Thank you so much. Keep that in mind. The lady in the back row, yes. Please.
In different times that I can see us actually feeling like that the solution is money, money, money. However, in the times that we're living in right now, in our country, where we're all in a situation that we have to pull together to make it work for the best of us to help the least of us, or I should say the blessed of us, to help the least of us. However, in this time, we have to think out of the box. We have to think out of the box and understand that the brilliance of whomever put partnerships in the name of our offices is what we really have to put our arms around more often and utilize partnerships to create opportunities for us to be able to help the least of us. And we're somehow forgetting that piece, and we're thinking that the government has a lot of money to do this and that. The government hardly have enough money to employ all of us. So, and I'm not saying that this is anything negative. I love America. I love the American government. But I want us to just be a little more realistic about where we are at this time in our history. And for us to understand that partnerships, if we put together programs that I can use you, one hand can reach the other and say, here's how together we can put what we have in motion to help the least of us, then we can really get this done. But we're not thinking out of the box. And when you are sometimes a person who thinks out of the box, you stay in trouble a little bit because people are like, well, how are you figuring this out? Where are you getting out of this? What are you? You must be doing something that's different or doing something that's not according to government order. But we've got to think out of the box. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is a very out-of-the-box panel, so I appreciate that. Let's take one more right in the back and then just turn around. Yeah, there you go.
So Max Finberg, I direct the center at the Department of Agriculture. As Joshua mentioned, a number of us who do that are here, and thrilled that both Rebecca and Mark and brother up front mentioned it. But those partnerships from the Department of Agriculture work with faith-based organizations in amazing ways that don't involve government grants. And it's a very easy thing to find the common ground of feed my sheep in the churches, to the spread table, El Ma'ida, in the Quran with Muslim mosques and congregations. Rabbi Saperstein will do the Torah reading a little later over lunch, but it's all there. And so I'm curious from the panel, when it comes to feeding the hungry, because both of you mentioned that, what are some of the research, what's some of the effects that might be there in some of these non-grant programs that are using faith-based organizations, congregations, for more than just the volunteers or the space, although that turns out to be a great part of the partnership.
Thank you so much. And lastly, this is a total bias on my part. Michelle Borstein of the Washington Post. I want you to join us, too.
Thank you. I'm one of the religion reporters at the Washington Post. So I'm trying to do the reporter big picture question, which is in this whole debate about whether faith-based providers are better or worse, et cetera. So what, basically? I mean, what's going to happen as a result of something that sounds like a consensus among some of the researchers? I mean, is there a sense that that's going to lead to more or less funding for faith-based groups or private funding or government funding? I mean, is that shifting? What's the ramifications of what you're saying?
I knew you'd get to a really good bottom line question. Bless you for that.
I can start. I mean, I think it's related in some ways to the question about policy. And I guess I'd say that the big news is, you know, we're talking a lot about eradicating poverty. And I think, you know, the hunger programs and all of that we need, but we also need strategies to pull people out of poverty. So, you know, people coming out of prison who don't, you know, are undereducated and can't get living wage jobs. I mean, those types of things to me, at the end of the day, are the measure in terms of what the impact is. And from my perspective, while I find that the debate incredibly interesting between the FBOs and the secular world, at the end of the day, it's about effective programming. And so from my perspective, it's an important question because, in fact, you know, if or not the FBOs are more effective at service delivery or certain types of service delivery, then we need to utilize that strategy and make sure that there's funding available. And I just want to say quickly to echo Rebecca's point about the money is, you know, related to effective service, it's just an elephant that you can't get around. And, you know, we work with tons of organizations with the best of intentions who, you know, a case manager handling a load of 100 people, you know, who need housing and food and all those things, is not going to be able to run an effective program. So I just don't want effectiveness and quality programming to be lost in this discussion, because without it, you know, we're wasting money essentially on things that potentially don't work. So I think that's important.
Okay. Now, on the funding issue, there's a couple points that I'd like to make. I think, first of all, we need to think in terms of, you know, a large pot of money that's been designated for dealing with whether it's poverty or prisoner reentry programs, et cetera. And one question is, how large should that pot, overall pot, be? And I personally would like to see it to be bigger than what it is, much bigger, in fact. But given budget deficits, the mood in Washington, I think that's not going to happen. It's unlikely to happen. Anyway, the second question then is, okay, given that pot of money, which politically speaking, realistically speaking, is probably pretty well fixed where it is, how is that going to be distributed? To whom is it going to go? And I guess the point I would try to make would be that faith-based organizations and, you know, non-faith-based organizations, government programs, privately run programs, they all should have a fair shot at that pot of money, and we should not say, okay, because you're this type of an organization, you take a lower seat at the table. But rather, partialing out that pot of money should depend more upon, one, the effectiveness of the various programs. You know, hey, I visited very good faith-based programs and very lousy faith-based programs. The same for nonprofit programs. You should talk about which are well run, which have the capacity, et cetera, et cetera. Secondly, I think it was you, Mark, that mentioned this, what I would call niche effectiveness. That is, some programs can do some things very well and other things not very well. I mean, in the welfare to work area where I've done quite a bit of research, and again, this is more impressionistic rather than that, you know, I can cite all kinds of data for this. But it seems like many of the government-run programs, such as community colleges, are very good at imparting certain technical skills, job skills, whether it's computer keyboarding or whatever might be the case, whereas many of the faith-based organizations are better at providing the kind of supportive services, such as childcare services or transportation, et cetera. And it may be that, given the limited funds that are out there, we need to think in terms of both and the niche effectiveness rather than in terms of these very broad categories.
Rebecca? Well, I was just going to go back to one of the first things they talked about, which is that when this all started, when the state liaisons were going out there, when this office started, they didn't take that first step, which was going around, talking to people, talking to faith groups, talking to nonprofits, finding out what worked, what connections were already out there, and what was happening, and then working within those and really making those better. So, like what Mark talked about, the congregations in Tucson, and one of those things that could have made that even better was, you know, reaching out to new congregations in different locations. So homeless people had more were easily, more easily accessible congregations. Why they were all sort of centered in one area of downtown. So, you know, you had to kind of be around this one area to be able to access that. And I mean, I think that there's a lot of things that are happening and going on right now that people just need to be paying more attention to and really thinking about systematically instead of just going in and, you know, saying, oh, faith-based initiative's great, let's start this whole new thing all over again when a lot of the stuff is already happening already.
I just want to underscore the importance of Rebecca's research in this respect. You know, we talk about Stanley's pot of money. So much of this money, it does not come directly from the federal government. Even if it comes from the federal government, it is passed through state governments or local governments, and it's one of the reasons why it's been so hard to do some research on this, because it's hard. You can't just draw straight lines from Washington to a program on the ground. But so that's why another reason why it's so good you've done, been doing this research. Mark.
I'll make 3 points. One, the so what question. I think it's been very difficult to answer the so what question from the beginning of the faith-based initiative. It's been very difficult to get a real handle on exactly what the problem was that was supposed to be solved by the faith-based initiative. Part of the problem was that the early definitions of the problem, that we had a playing field that was prejudiced against religious organizations, just wasn't true. And so the language of we need to level the playing field in competitions for public money is just a massive, you know, there were early Pew did surveys where they said 75% of Americans think religious organizations shouldn't be discriminated against. And that's why, but religious organizations weren't discriminated against. So it's been hard to get a handle from the beginning on what exactly was at stake, unless you did a very cynical interpretation, of course, about the politics, which I try to avoid doing the cynical interpretation. No, I not in public. I try not to do that. I don't know what when EJ first called me, I said, really? People are focused on this still? But here we are, and here are all our views. So that's my first comment. I think it's very difficult to get a handle on what's actually at stake here. My second comment is I think one of the most important legacies of the faith-based initiative is knowledge. Generated a lot of research on religious organizations and effectiveness, and we know a lot more now than we did a decade ago because it generated a lot of questions. And that knowledge doesn't go away, unlike policy initiatives and so on. The knowledge won't go away, and I think there will be ways to build on to target things and such like. I think that's maybe the most important legacy actually of this initiative is that the knowledge, what we've learned about religion and religion's role. And the third thing I want to say is on a targeting thing, I've become intrigued, and it's come up a little bit on the various kinds of comments, I've become intrigued by the role of congregations in particular in public health things. Somebody mentioned the H1N1 programs. I think Joshua did. I think somebody else did. I think there's a line of research out there on that they've on breast cancer education working through church, breast cancer screening maybe working through churches. And so I'm intrigued by the role of congregations as conduits of information and public education, particularly about health issues as a maybe specific, again, not in the real sexy dimension, but as a you know, 20% of the American population is gathered, on Sundays, essentially. It's not 40%, by the way. That's a whole other line of research about Americans overstate their church attendance. But about 20% of the American population is attend services on any given weekend. And, you know, unless maybe that's a pretty good venue mechanism for doing public education on certain kind, you know, unless you can get American Idol or something to do thing. I mean, where else do you have that many people? So I think I'm kind of intrigued by some of the public health possibilities in church.
I like to tell one of the churches that was part of the network of feeding program in Tucson also had a monthly dental clinic in their church. And so not only were they doing all this work kind of orchestrating and gathering people to help feed the homeless, but then they would have dentists from their congregation come in every Sunday for 4 or 5 hours and have them do a dental clinic. And so I think a lot of these, what you're seeing is there's a lot of congregations that are very, very active, and then a lot of congregations that aren't really doing anything at all. And when I, one of the more intriguing things, when I was in Florida on a totally other different experience, I was at a church and the pastor passed out a questionnaire to his congregation. And he, it wasn't, you know, what are you willing to do or how much can you give? It was, what are your expertise? I know, are you an accountant? Are you a dentist? Are you a doctor? Here's your phone number. He went around and he picked him up because, and his whole sermon was about how it was, you know, as the church, their duty to help those in need and how we were facing this time of crisis where we all needed to pull together. And so it wasn't an optional exercise for his congregation. It was, what are we going to do? How are we going to leverage what we have here and make our community a better place?
Let's see. Could we, I'm told I've got to cut it off, but I'm partial to people of the cloth who are in the room. Let me, could we get you in real quickly? And the gentleman behind you, if you could both be very quick. Emily is trying to deprive me of mics here because she wants me to cut it off. But could you go real quickly and then we'll, and loud, and then we'll close it down?
Isn't there an elephant in the room that's invisible, that's always there? Why do we accept that? Aren't, in faith-based initiatives, aren't we supposed to be the conscience? Shouldn't we be, when they ask for something, they might actually get it, and they may not have gotten it yet. So shouldn't we be the ones that say, there is money there, and you're spending it wrong? Shouldn't we be the leaven that can say, I would say, close down those 700 bases in Europe, military bases, and stop being a Department of War, be a Department of Defense? Be a conscience, because the money is there, the need is there, and we ought to be the ones saying something about it. If we're going to be faith-based initiatives, I don't think we should be the ones just groveling around looking for the last crumb and trying to share the crumb. Shouldn't we say, there's where it is, and then change society that way?
I knew a man or woman of the cloth would have something important to say. Thank you. And then last comment.
My name is Ezio Castelli. I'm working for an international development organization. I would like to stress what I think was mentioned, but in good part missing the debate, that is the human resources, the human being, the person who implements program, which according to me makes a lot of difference more than very design programs. I agree on some consideration that the so narrow program are less effective than comprehensive program. But I think that considering our main experience, which makes the difference in our life, is people we meet and the quality of people with whom we are involved. I think a bit too much emphasis is made on the perfection of a program. But what about the people who are implementing, not only designing the program, implementing? What makes the difference when, substance abuse people as, considering the people who this guy meets?
Thank you.
The quality of the human person.
Thank you very much.
This takes up to the faith-based matters.
Thank you so much. Does anyone have a closing comment they want to make? I just want to say one thing, which is that I've still been thinking of the lady who talked about the blessed of us and least of us. Jim Wallace, who many of you know, once told a story that's always struck with me as we debate these things. And he talked about, yes, you're sitting next to a river, and you see somebody drowning and you go in the river and you help the person. And then somebody else comes along and is drowning and you go in to try to help them. And Wallace asks the question, at some point, don't you ask who or what is throwing people in the river, up the river? And I just want to thank and praise this panel, because I think in the research they've done, the concerns they've had, they care both about the most effective ways to pull people out of the river when they come by, but also ask the question, why are they getting into the river in the first place? And I want to thank you all for a really great and fact-based and enlightening conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here with us this morning. It is truly an amazing group that is gathered here today, and we could pretty much select put you in groups of 8 or 10 and have excellent panels running for consecutive days. So it's just a testament to the great people in the crowd here. And speaking of beating each other's brains out, we're going to discuss the legal issues now. So, no, I'm just joking. Seriously, though, we are blessed to have a really terrific panel to talk about these issues today. And one of the things that's striking to me in listening to the previous panels is it's interesting and sometimes challenging in this discussion, because sometimes the formal legal rules and the practical realities aren't always consistent. They don't fit together that well. And so one of our challenges today will be to talk about legal theory, laws, and policy, and policy particularly that has legal dimensions, and not let that get too divorced from practical realities, and indeed try to work to make these things align better. So I think that's part of our work that we have to focus on today. Let me take just a moment to take a hop, skip, and jump through a couple of historical issues before I introduce each of our panelists. Those of you in this room know that President Bush's administration certainly raised the visibility of social service partnerships with the government and religious and secular nonprofits, but it did not invent these partnerships. These partnerships, as you know, have been around for a long time, and their visibility has gotten greater, but that doesn't mean that they didn't exist prior to the Bush administration. I think all sides, though, would agree that the Bush administration brought about some substantial changes in the formal church-state rules governing these partnerships, and that begins to launch us into some of the areas of conflict. The Supreme Court, as Bob Tuttle will talk about in a moment, has been in the midst of something of a paradigm shift over the past few decades, and we're still, I would say, in the midst of that. And so these developments of the faith-based initiative and charitable choice have been in discussion with those Supreme Court developments, a loosening of some of the Establishment Clause interpretations, the way that the First Amendment Establishment Clause is interpreted by the court, and the way in which policy both reacts to those loosening of those restrictions and in some degree perhaps even spurs loosening of those restrictions. So those of you who have followed this know that charitable choice emerged in the mid-1990s as a way to restructure some of the relationships between church and state in this area, and that the Clinton administration reacted to charitable choice by signing it into law a couple of times, but also by trying to soften some of its more controversial elements. Charitable choice, among its notable aspects, was that it tried to set up a set of rules that would flow across situations in which federal funds flow to non-governmental organizations to provide social services. And it said that any religious organization could participate in competing for those funds, and also said some other things that tended to be real flashpoints, such as religious organizations would be permitted to make decisions on the basis of religion with regard to jobs that were funded either partially or fully by government funds. So that was put on the table in the mid-1990s. The Clinton administration reacted to that in some way. And then, of course, as you know, President Bush took office and opened his own faith-based office. Initially tried to get some legislation that would extend this legislative concept of charitable choice into all areas where federal social service funds are involved and go to non-governmental organizations. That effort failed, and then the Bush administration turned toward putting these charitable choice-like ideas into place through federal executive order and changes in regulations and policies. There were some significant departures from the charitable choice model, but it, largely speaking, the Bush administration hewed to the charitable choice model. As you know, we talked about the campaign this morning and President Obama opening his own office of faith-based and neighborhood partnerships. It was mentioned this morning that the the faith-based office exists, as well as an advisory council that has been asked to look at some of the legal issues in this area. I've been involved in that just as a disclosure, and I want to let you know that some recommendations that we will be making on the legal issues will be finalized in the next month. If you would like a copy of the drafts of those recommendations, you can go to the White House Partnerships blog, where there's more information about those drafts and a way for you to request those drafts. Well, let me just now turn to the introductions of the panel. The panel is going to look at how the law has changed or stayed and not changed over the past year, and how these trends in the courts, in the legislatures, and in the executive branch around policies and laws that deal with church-state issues when religious groups and others are involved in delivering government-funded services or helping government to get out its own services that it funds. We'll also look at what might or should happen over the next year, whether in the federal level or the state level. And we will also talk about some of the other issues about how these kind of legal rules can be brought to bear on practical situations in which religious groups or others are involved, and how we can improve the situation by providing clearer guidance to religious providers and others who are delivering government-funded social services. Let me turn and introduce each of our panelists. First, we have Bob Tuttle, who is a professor of law and professor of law and religion at George Washington University Law School. He has, after completing his law education, he earned a PhD in religious ethics from the University of Virginia. He also holds a master's degree from the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, and he serves as legal counsel to the Washington, D.C. Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, as well as a board member of Lutheran Services in America. So you can see that Bob has it all covered. He, along with his colleague Chip Lupu at George Washington University, served from 2002 to 2008 as co-director of legal analysis for the Roundtable on Religion and Social Welfare Policy. And I know many of you know Chip and Bob's terrific work through that project and how helpful they have been to all of us in shaping the dialogue and indeed shaping policy on these issues. And so, as I can say, as one who's profited from Chip and Bob's advice on many occasions, I want to thank them, and I'm so grateful that Bob can be with us today. Steve McFarland will speak next. He serves as Chief Legal Officer for World Vision, a Christian international relief and development ministry serving vulnerable children worldwide. He directed the Center for Law and Religious Freedom of the Christian Legal Society in the 90s, and I had the good fortune of working with Steve then, and I can tell you how much I appreciate his good spirit in all of those interactions, even when we disagreed. And since then has had a great career in spearheading President Bush's faith-based and community initiative in the U.S. Department of Justice. He was the first executive director of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and he also worked with Prison Fellowship International to develop programs for prisoners abroad. So I'm very grateful that Steve can be with us both to comment on his current work for World Vision, all of his past work, as you heard, in particular his work at the Department of Justice, to the extent that he's able to address some of those issues as well. That's very helpful. Dan Mack is with us today as well. He is director of litigation at the ACLU's Program on Freedom of Religion and Belief. He litigates and coordinates a wide range of religious liberty cases, and indeed he has led in many cases that involve issues of government-funded social services and religious organizations. So we're particularly grateful for his expertise there. Prior to his work at the ACLU, Dan was a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Jenner and Block, where he specialized in First Amendment law. So we're grateful, Dan, you can be with us. I want to also introduce my friend Noel Castellanos, who currently serves as the chief executive officer of the Christian Community Development Association. Noel has worked in full-time ministry and urban community since 1982. He has a new book coming out, A Heart for the Community, in it's come out already in 2009. So you can buy that on Amazon, too, when you're looking a little later today. He has also served on the President's Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Initiatives, and it's been my great pleasure to work with Noel in that capacity. Noel is not a lawyer, and he is going to do us a great service in that he is going to give us a reality check on how these things actually work. After we tell you how they should work or how they might work, Noel will tell us actually how they do work, and he will provide a great sounding board for us as we work through these difficult issues and trying to come together to help people in need in ways that are effective and constitutional. So with no further ado, let me ask and welcome Bob to kick us off.
Thanks very much, Melissa and EJ, for the invitation to be here. Chip apologizes he's not here. We actually are severable. For those of you that have never seen us, we're teaching a class together this semester. We flipped a coin. I'm here, he's there. I won't say who won. My task is really to lay out the relevant legal backdrop for the discussion that Steve and Dan and Noel will engage in. There are four decisions that, for lawyers, essentially frame our universe in thinking about government funding of faith-based social services. 2000 decision Mitchell against Helms on direct aid of government to religious organizations. 2002 Zelman versus Simmons-Harris on indirect or voucher financing. 2004, Locke against Davey on the question of whether government funding of religion was constitutionally compelled. And then 2007, Hine versus the Freedom from Religion Foundation on the question of taxpayer standing. So those four decisions I'm going to go through very, very briefly. For questions of substantive law, Mitchell against Helms 2000 is by far the most important decision. It's the most important because it deals with direct funding. Direct funding is the vast majority. Indirect funding is nice and attractive, boutique-y, but direct aid is where the money is at for most government funding of social welfare services. A line of decision starting in the early 1970s, had said that the government cannot directly fund, quote, pervasively sectarian organizations because, number one, the government can't fund religious indoctrination. And, number two, you can't trust pervasively sectarian organizations not to divert government funds into religious indoctrination. And even if you thought you could keep them, you can't monitor because the monitors will get too much involved into religious life. So that set the framework really for almost 20 years, for more than 20 years, 25 years, until 1997's case, Agostini against Felton. But really, for our purposes, it's Mitchell against Helms. The case involved a program where the government gave a variety of kinds of direct aid, that is, physical objects, audiovisual equipment, computers, and other things, to all schools, both public and private, including religious schools. Question was whether parochial schools could receive those things. Three dissenters on the court said no, that the goods are divertible, they could be used for religious indoctrination, and the government can't monitor. So essentially, the 1970s opinions should remain intact, but they lost. Four, the plurality on the court said it doesn't matter whether government funds are used for religious indoctrination. All that matters is whether the process for selecting grantees was neutral between religion and non-religion and whether the goods were secular in kind. And there was computers. There's nothing particularly religious about computers. The four plurality are in the majority, but they didn't win. The controlling law is, in one of these odd circumstances, a rule that's adhered to by only two justices, Justice O'Connor in a concurring opinion joined by Justice Breyer. And the concurrence says diversion matters. The government is responsible for making sure that government funds don't fund religious indoctrination. But you don't have to distrust religious organizations. As long as you have adequate safeguards, as long as the adequate safeguards are monitored in good faith, the government can directly fund a religious organization. Now, why is this important? Because it displaces concern from the identity of the organization, is it faith-based or not, to the identity of the service being funded. That's the paradigm shift. That's the dramatic change. And that really describes our universe with respect to direct funding. So what it means is we've got to figure out whether you have adequate safeguards and whether there is adequate monitoring. That's the thing that we focused on when we wrote about and thought about the faith-based initiative, is really measuring the quality of the guidance that government gives. And as many of you all know, Chip and I were quite critical, although I hope critical in good faith, about the administration's work. In one respect, the faith-based initiative was very important in realizing the promise of Mitchell against Helms. In contrast to Mark, I do think that there was some discrimination. It may not have been in practice, but it was in law. The 2001-2002 study done about removing barriers did identify an awful lot of obstacles to religious organizations that wanted to participate, because the obstacles were, if you are an organization of a particular kind, don't bother applying, right? So whether that was true in practice or not is a different question, but the rules were there and the rules were changed. The problem is that's only half the story. And the other half of the story, you're allowed to participate, but you have to be constrained. There, the administration didn't do such a good job. Whether it was ineffective in just being not complete in its advice, or whether it was indifferent to the constitutional consequences, something that people can, of course, disagree about. But one of the good things to see in the recommendations now of the task force is a commitment to clear and accurate standards. That's been something that really was developing in the last couple of years of the Bush administration. I know that that Dan will talk about the Silver Ring Thing settlement, but the idea of making clear exactly what government funds can be used for and not used for, and monitoring, how those monitoring standards are developed, how they are implemented, I think there's a good reason to be hopeful about that. Now, it's possible that this law will change. It's possible that the plurality opinion in Mitchell will become the controlling law. But as far as we're all concerned right now, that's not the law. Nobody knows what will happen when it comes back, if it comes back to the Supreme Court again. The O'Connor opinion in Mitchell is the law on direct aid. 2002 was important because Zelman versus Simmons-Harris said, if you want to get government funding to religious services that involve religious transformation, that involve what the court in Mitchell called religious indoctrination, the way to do it is through vouchers. And that, as many of you all know, was the Cleveland School voucher case. And the idea there is the direct aid rules don't apply if you have a program of indirect aid where the beneficiary is allowed to choose from a wide variety of options, including religious options. If that's the case and the beneficiary chooses to use that voucher for religious instruction, as long as there's a neutral process and the beneficiary did have a real choice, it's constitutionally permissible for government funds to reach religious organizations. The administration, the Bush administration, quickly picked that up in terms of faith-based social services, and it's been a very promising alternative, especially in substance abuse treatment and a number of areas. But there are a variety of reasons, practical reasons, that it may not be the preferred route for a number of social services, partly because social service providers can't count on any guaranteed stream of income if they have to be dependent entirely on particular service recipients. The third case, Locke against Davy, 2004, a scholarship program for Washington higher education. The state law said you can't use this scholarship, this voucher, for religious instruction. In that case, it was for a program to prepare for the ministry. The recipient of the program, Joshua Davy, said it's unconstitutional. You are doing something to me that you wouldn't do to an analogous a student who wanted to receive analogous secular education. That violates my rights to free exercise and to free speech. It's on its surface, it seems like a very compelling argument. The Constitution, the federal Constitution, does not prohibit government funds being used for that kind of scholarship program. So if the state of Washington would allow it, why are they singling out religious instruction for special prohibition? The court, by a vote of 7-2, said no. It is not unconstitutional to restrict funding to secular or certain kinds of secular programming. If you take a broad reading of Locke against Davy, which is not the only way to read it, but if you take a broad reading of Locke against Davy, the way you look at that is to say that the faith-based initiative or any program of government funding of social welfare services may but is not constitutionally required to fund religious organizations as part of it, right? It's policy discretion. This administration has chosen to further those lines, but this administration could also take us back to the place we were in 2001 with formal restrictions on government aid to religious organizations. Now, I'm not sure that's the best way to read Locke against Davey, but it is one way of reading it. There's an interesting Tenth Circuit decision on Colorado Christian University that perhaps we can talk about in the questions that raises some issue about whether you could impose that kind of reading of Locke on something like this, the faith-based initiative. And finally, the 2000 decision in Hine versus Freedom from Religion Foundation. As many of you all know, that is Jay Hine, who was then the Josh Dubois for the previous administration. The Freedom from Religion Foundation sued over the faith-based initiative, specifically over the conferences and even more specifically over the speeches by officials at those events. Now, it was a very weak case from the beginning, but it's not the merits that make this case interesting. It's the procedures. And if I said Mitchell against Helms is the most important case substantively, Hine versus Freedom from Religion Foundation is the most important case practically. Because in Hine, the Supreme Court said that taxpayers do not have standing to bring an Establishment Clause challenge unless Congress has specifically authorized government funding for religious activities, essentially. Now, I don't want to rehearse the long and convoluted line of taxpayer standing cases, but this is a very sharply divided court. Four justices said the plaintiffs in that case should have standing, they should be able to proceed. Two justices, Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, said there should never be taxpayer standing to challenge Establishment Clause cases. We don't have taxpayer standing in other circumstances. A three-justice plurality said that as long as there is some nexus, maybe a strong degree of nexus, between a legislative decision and the spending of money on religion, then we'll at least be able to entertain these cases. But most cases don't involve that kind of nexus. Most cases involve the Congress appropriating money, and the executive makes those kinds of decisions. And there's some real serious questions about the extent to which most programs that involve religious grantees could be challenged. Just to briefly rehash, direct aid, a ban on the use of funds for religious activities, but religious organizations are equally eligible to apply. An indirect aid program, as long as it's properly designed, can include not just religious organizations, but religious activities. But under Locke against Davey, this is discretionary. It's not constitutionally mandatory to include religious organizations. And finally, as a practical matter, it may be tough to find the right plaintiff to bring a challenge, even if on the constitutional merits a program is open to challenge.
Thank you so much. Steve, I believe you have a PowerPoint, right?
I do. Good morning. Josh, this morning, said that the religious hiring rights issue would be reviewed carefully and with all due diligence, and it is my 7 minutes to talk about at least the legal framework in which that careful review can or should be addressed. The question, let me just start with what the question is not. The question that has already been answered 46 years ago is, can a faith-based organization remain faith-based through its hiring policies? That is not the issue we're talking about. That was decided in the 64 Civil Rights Act, Section 702. Congress wisely, and President Johnson signing it, recognized that the government should not be in the business of telling religious employers, religious associations, organizations, corporations, societies, who they should be hiring with respect to their religion. That decision was reaffirmed in 1972. I should move us along here. There we go. Title VII, as you know, is the sweeping federal, the comprehensive federal regulation of employment discrimination. And in that law, there is an explicit exemption, as I said, for religious organizations to prefer folks of their own faith in hiring. Oops, let's try that. I should mention also that Title VI addresses federal funding, and religion was not included in Title VI. And that would have been an appropriate place for the Congress, if it wished to have it the rule that they were putting in Title VII with respect to employment discrimination, change if federal funds were involved. That would have been a good place for Congress to put it, and they did not. And, matter of fact, religion is not addressed in Title VI at all. In 72, the decision was once again reaffirmed when President Nixon signed an amendment to the 64 Act to make sure that it was unequivocally clear that this applied to any job from custodian to president of the religious organization. They dropped the term religious activities. It's now any activities. That was in 1972. 1987, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, stated that it was perfectly constitutional, that the First Amendment certainly was not violated when Congress chose to provide that kind of protection for the religious autonomy of religious organizations. That's the Amos case. In 1993, President Clinton signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and that was one of the opportunities that a number of us had to work with Melissa and many others in an extraordinary bipartisan and ecumenical and very broad coalition. And Religious Freedom Restoration Act, what it basically states is that the government has to have a real good reason, a compelling government interest, to deny an exemption from a law that has been proven by a particular religious entity to be a substantial burden on their religious faith or exercise. We'll get to how that impacts the question we're talking about. Then in 1996, Congress passed and President Clinton signed the Welfare to Work Bill, which guaranteed that faith-based organizations are eligible to apply for government grants without compromising their religious autonomy. And this was in the context of the overhauling the welfare system, but once again, you had a clarion call for a equal access of faith-based social service providers to compete for federal funding. 2001, President Bush created his initiative, as you know, and in that executive order directed executive agencies to enforce the law that arguably, as we've just described, was already the law, and that is to not discriminate against faith-based organizations applying for federal grants. With respect to with all due respect about previous statements that there wasn't any discrimination, I can attest that when I remember when I was working for Prison Fellowship International and applied for submitted their first application for a federal grant to provide for tuberculosis prevention in Russian prisons, and I was told by the gatekeeper, the registrar at USAID, that I would need to amend the articles of incorporation of Prison Fellowship International to specifically state certain things, such as that we served all people regardless of faith, and similar edicts that she had to suggest for our articles of incorporation. I can only imagine what a smaller organization that didn't have our resources and didn't have an in-house legal counsel would have done when confronted with that that kind of ultimatum. You can't even submit your application. They sent the entire application back to us in the same envelope and said, if you even want to be considered, we're going to dictate to you what your articles are going to say. So there was discrimination, and the executive order was designed to make sure that the 2 million civilian employees of the federal government were not had got the message that a level playing field was now the law of the land. And it wasn't, didn't become the law of the land in 2001 through that executive order. It was clarifying what a message that had been sent 46 years ago, earlier. Then finally, 2007, the Department of Justice, the Office of Legal Counsel, which is the office that interprets and opines officially on the impact of legislation, what the law says and how it applies in different contexts, that office, in a 25-page opinion, which you can still find on the Justice Department website, stated that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 93 that President Clinton signed, that I mentioned earlier, could be reasonably construed to provide on a case-by-case basis, not a blanket basis, but a case-by-case basis, an exemption for religious social service organizations, such as, in this case, World Vision, to compete for federal funding, even in a program where Congress had a general ban on employment discrimination. That is still the operative interpretation of RFRA as it applies to this issue, and I hope it'll remain that way. 2009, President Obama did not change that issue. Despite his Zanesville speech as a candidate, he left the law unchanged, laudably, in my opinion, and he referred the issue of religious hiring preference by faith-based grantees to the Justice Department on a case-by-case basis. I have no idea whether they've been inundated with such referrals or there have been none whatsoever. But the OLC opinion hasn't changed. The executive orders haven't changed. The unanimous decision of the Supreme Court hasn't been overturned. And the 64 and 72 amendments to the Civil Rights Act have not been changed. And Congress, and I commend them for not doing it, Congress would be the best place for our democratic institutions to state whether all bets are off when you accept federal funds. They have not done so. I hope they won't. And finally, just 2 months ago, the Supreme Court announced that it had granted cert. In other words, it would review this term, a case which will address the constitutional issue that undergirds this this question. In the case of Christian Legal Society versus Martinez, it involves a student-led group at Hastings Law School in California, part of the University of California, that among, like many other student groups, wanted to meet on campus. In order to meet on campus on an equal basis with other student organizations, you had to be, quote, officially recognized. They applied for and were denied that because, not because they were choosy about who could come to their meetings, who could participate in their meetings, but because a Christian organization wanted its leaders, those who would be leading the Bible study, to be Christian and to have a what they considered to be a biblically appropriate view of human sexuality. That case is now going to the Supreme Court. I believe it'll be argued on April 20th, and we should have an opinion, hopefully, by the 4th of July. So in 7 minutes, I think those are the salient channel markers for this issue, which is the big elephant in the room that hasn't really been directly addressed thus far. So turn it over to Dan.
Thank you very much, Steve. Dan, welcome you.
I'm just going to stay seated if that's okay with everyone. First, thanks to Melissa and EJ for having us here, and Brookings as well. and thanks to you all for coming this morning. I'll talk a bit about what has happened in the past year on the legal front, and then, as Melissa suggests, I will then talk about what, in my opinion, should happen in the coming months and years. The first part will be pretty short, actually. For those of you who've been following these issues, not that much has happened in the past year. Bob did an excellent job of summarizing what the law is as dictated by the Supreme Court in previous decisions. Since then, not much has happened. I will just talk about one area of the law, and it's the driest and most boring part. But it's very important. That is standing, and as Bob mentioned, standing affects whether anyone, whether and who can march into court to challenge unconstitutional or allegedly unconstitutional activity. And with the Hine decision, a lot of lower courts have taken a rather broad reading of Hine and have limited standing, limited who can bring challenges to what they claim are unconstitutional government expenditures on religion. And I think that's highly problematic. I think that's a misreading of Hine. I think it's dangerous, and it could lead to a situation where Congress could pass all sorts of unconstitutional government endorsements of religion. They could set up a fund funneling hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars to houses of worship with no restrictions whatsoever. And as long as they didn't name those churches in the statute itself, under one reading of Hine, then no one could go to court and challenge that, and I think that's dangerous. There have been a few positive developments, and I'll just talk about one in this area of standing, and that is in a case that we at the ACLU brought with Americans United for Separation of Church and State. It is a challenge to, among other things, the government funding of a Kentucky Baptist group home to which the state sends vulnerable youth in its care. This is an organization that's largely funded by federal and state tax dollars, more than $100 million in state funds since 2000, in fact. And the organization is quite clear that it has a religious mission and that its programs are religiously infused. They proselytize kids entrusted to their care, and they also discriminate against, among others, gay employees who don't share their religious belief that homosexuality is sinful. So there was an employment discrimination piece to that case, and there was also a taxpayer piece to that, taxpayers challenging the funding of the organization. The district court in that case threw out the case, the taxpayer bit, saying that after Hine, taxpayers don't have standing to challenge this sort of funding. We were pleased in August of last year that the Court of Appeals in the Sixth Circuit reversed that decision and allowed the case to go forward. So that's one positive development on that front. There are a lot of challenges on the litigation front. We and our allies will remain vigilant and keep a watchful eye. But litigation is hardly the only answer, and many of the persistent problems can be fixed by other branches of government. On the anniversary of President Obama's executive order creating the new White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, a broad coalition of groups, civil rights and civil liberties groups, labor, health organizations, all under the banner of the CARD Coalition, which is the Coalition Against Religious Discrimination, sent the White House a letter. And I would point out at this point that many of those groups were ardent and vocal supporters of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that was referred to by Steve earlier. In that letter, we urged that a number of steps be taken to safeguard religious liberty and to correct some of the mistakes of the past. And in my remaining time, I'll just touch on a few of those suggestions. First, not surprisingly, I think we believe that President Obama should follow through on his campaign promise to prohibit taxpayer-funded employment discrimination. This is an area where we obviously disagree. The current administration inherited a Bush-era program that had reversed decades of civil rights protections. And it's interesting, I know that Steve suggested that Congress should be the best place to impose restrictions on employment discrimination in federally funded programs. That's exactly what Congress has done in many circumstances. There are many funding statutes that include those explicit protections, and yet we have the OLC memo out there that interprets those away, basically. So when Congress refused to go along with the Bush plan, the Bush administration unilaterally stripped funding streams of constitutional safeguards. And in my view, that OLC memo needs to be withdrawn, and I think it's wrong both as a matter of law and policy. Now, it's true, of course, that religious organizations are entitled to make hiring decisions on the basis of faith, as Steve pointed out, that has been the case for a while. But I think it's entirely different when we're talking about government funding. I think it's simply wrong, not to mention unconstitutional, for taxpayers to foot the bill for positions to which they can't even apply simply because of their faith. I think the legal analysis in that opinion is deeply flawed. We can talk more about that later if there's time. I know Bob has opined on this as well. Beyond the employment discrimination piece, I think the administration should adopt the helpful draft consensus recommendations that Melissa referred to earlier by the Reform Task Force. Melissa is the chair of the Advisory Council, and Noel is a member. There are many useful recommendations in there, too many to mention here, but a few are worth highlighting. One, there's the suggestion of clarifying the prohibited uses of direct federal financing. The current regulations are too narrow and confusing, and they lead to widespread violations. Next, the recommendations helpfully suggest emphasizing the separation requirements that are contained in the law. This follows from the previous recommendation about being clear about what's prohibited and what isn't. And it would help ensure that religious activities and materials are privately funded and kept distinct from government services. The Council's recommendations in this regard build on a settlement in a case that we brought. The settlement was reached in 2006. It was a challenge to federal grants to an organization called the Silver Ring Thing. The Silver Ring Thing is a Christian ministry that, as the group itself has explained, uses abstinence-only education as a vehicle for bringing unchurched students to Jesus Christ. In the 3 years prior to the filing of our lawsuit, they had received over $1 million in HHS grants. So after we sued, the grants to the organization that were then in place were permanently suspended, and as part of a global settlement, it was determined that any future funding would have to comply with these safeguards. There were a set of detailed guidelines requiring the separation of religious materials and activities from those programs that are actually funded by the government. I think it's a very helpful thing HHS did. HHS did the right thing. I want to commend them on that. But federal agencies shouldn't have to wait for a lawsuit before acting, and I share the Advisory Council's recommendation that those safeguards be implemented across the board. I think it's also important to improve monitoring. The government has a constitutional obligation to follow the money and to ensure compliance with the law, and all too often it has dropped the ball. And finally, it's important to assure the religious liberty rights of the beneficiaries and clients of these programs. After all, the point in these government funding schemes is to achieve valuable secular social service goals, not to favor particular faiths or ideologies. Of course, many faith-based organizations do great work, but when they accept taxpayer funds, they have to play by the rules. The current administration should seize the opportunity and indeed has an obligation to help make that happen.
Thank you so much, Dan. Now, Noel, we welcome you to give us that reality check.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The lawyers took us into the afternoon here. So, I think I will just springboard off of Dan's last comments, which I think are really get down to some of the practical considerations that I deal with on a daily basis, working with nonprofits and faith-based organizations all over the country who are trying to do good in communities that really need their services. That Dan said that that many faith-based organizations are doing great work, and I would like to just say amen to that, okay, and just say that that's really true. And for 25 years, you know, I started out as a youth worker, and very soon, even though part of my job as a Christian youth worker was to help young people learn about the Bible and things like that, in my community, we saw that there was all kinds of kids that were suffering from drug addiction to PCP in the Mexican community of San Jose. And so we began to work on preventing PCP addiction, and we went after federal funds for that, or local funds that had, you know, are channeled through the federal government. And the issue there was to try to deal with the addiction that these young people were going through, and we were willing to work at that. I moved to Chicago to the east, to the Mexican neighborhood of La Villita on the southwest side of Chicago, and then through a grant, initially through World Vision, and then through the Department of Housing in Chicago, we began to do low-income housing in that community. And while we were primarily there, you know, as a church that was trying to care for the community, we were quickly thrown into the field of saying, hey, we've got to address housing issues because they were a great concern. And so we were involved in that. Began doing gang intervention, began doing after-school programs, and then probably one of the most sophisticated and I think large-scale projects that we worked on over the last 25 years is the establishment of a health center on the west side of Chicago that serves 200,000 patient visits a year, $25 million a year organization. And as when I was president of that health clinic, we made the decision to begin taking federal funding for the work that we were doing there. Now, I would say all of these kind of things that are duplicated thousands times over by Christian groups and faith-based organizations around the country are really doing great things, as Dan mentioned. And I think the second thing he said as he closed his remarks were that that they ought to play by the rules, that these groups ought to play by the rules. And I would like to say that words like clarify, monitor, training, discrimination, communication of regulations and policy, separation, reporting, you know, all of these terms, if you enter into the world of government funding, you're very familiar with all of those terms. And we have not sought to bypass. And now I'm not saying that, that there are not, you know, instances where people are not compliant on every issue. I think a lot of the issue is understanding the rules and understanding what's going on, what's expected. So I just would like to make a few other points here just from my experience. Number one, along with all the caution that we, you know, are tended to bring up around this issue, we all also ought to celebrate all the good and amazing things that are going on. And I want to say that part of my job is to travel all over the country, and on, in the areas of compassion and service, community development and individual development and advocacy, some of the most amazing work is being done by people who are not paid enough, who don't have enough resource, and some get government funding, not all. But so I think we can celebrate the great stuff that's happening. Two is I believe that faith-based organizations have been effectively utilizing government funding for a long time. For 25 years, I just mentioned, I myself and others have been getting government funding from different levels, state, local, county, and even federal. And I would say that while as a whole, we may not be able to quantify the effectiveness, I don't think it's an issue of just faith-based groups, as was mentioned in our previous panel, but that all funding groups, anybody who's getting funding from the government, we need to do a better job of quantifying that. But to single out the faith groups and say, you know, hey, they're just not doing a good job, I don't know that any of us want to go there. Number three, while thousands of churches and faith-based groups do apply and receive federal funding, there's a lot more that don't, okay? And so I think it's just important to know that, that the millions and millions of dollars that are being invested by people of all faiths in doing good around the country is astronomical. And so, and I think that one of the reasons that people do not get into the mix or apply for federal funding is because they count the cost and they realize, you know what, I really don't want to compromise the way I run this program, or I don't, I'd rather do with less than to take government funding when I'm ambiguous about it. The other thing is, many small groups, they don't have the capacity, like we've already talked about, to be able to account for all the funding that but I think that doesn't mean that those that do apply are doing it poorly. Okay, so I think that's a good point to make. I think from my observation, I would say that most of the groups that I personally interact with, they want to be in compliance. You know, they're not trying to get over. They're not trying to skirt the rules. But I think the more they are clear, the better we will all be. And then I would say that large and small churches alike, I think, are those that do enter into the world of public, both indirect and direct funding, I think they're trying to do things right. I was recently at one of the largest union rescue missions in the country, okay, and right on Skid Row in Los Angeles, and there's a huge room, and 1,000 people are housed in that building every single night, and 500 men on one side, 500 women on the other side, and they get government funding for this warming shelter, okay? I didn't see any crosses. I didn't see, you know, I mean, it was a big, giant room with a television and a bunch of chairs. And it's, but, yeah, most of the staff are there motivated by their Christian faith in that instance. But, and then you take a small little church that opens up a warming center for 50 people on the west side of Chicago during the winter. And, you know, they don't have that same luxury to say we're going to build a, you know, special building just you know, free of any kind of icons or whatever, but yet the intention is to provide a warm place for people to come in from the cold from. Number six, and I just have two more points, okay, so you don't worry, is that I want to highlight the role of intermediaries and the importance of that they play, because as I work with so many groups around the country, it is the work of intermediaries that allows small congregations to get into the game, because while they don't have the capacity to apply for grants and do all of that, they know that if they get the money, they're going to have to comply with regulations. But groups like Lisa Cummings here, Urban Strategies, doing a fantastic job in Chicago of mobilizing congregations to begin addressing issues of, you know, of helping families become better functioning. And Esperanza USA is doing that with all kinds of groups around the country. Leadership Foundations providing technical aid. So there's the work of intermediaries, I think, is really important. And then I think the last thing is I just would emphasize again that when you enter into government funding, we have 5,000 organizations that we work with. Those that choose to do it with great seriousness, okay? They don't just say, oh,